Terrace, exploring the inspirational power of a garden in Salford.
There's lots of different types of plants around.
It's really helped with my mental health as well.
It's just a very joyful place, to be honest.
Sunrise Service, on Easter Sunday morning at 6:35, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Friday the 3rd of April. This is Today with Simon Jack in London and Anna Foster in Salford.
The headlines this morning, Marks & Spencer says retail crime is getting worse and it's accused the government and the Mayor of London of not doing enough to tackle it. We'll talk to a senior supermarket executive later in the programme. And a new democracy protection unit is helping police to deal with rising threats against MPs.
Also on the programme this morning, should the government allow more drilling for oil and gas to take place in the North Sea? A former chief executive of BP, Lord Brown, thinks so.
In order to have a proper approach to energy, right now, we need all sources available to us.
The triple lock on pensions is costly, but Reform UK now says it will keep it. Its Treasury spokesman, Robert Jenrick, will be here with us to explain why. And
we all agreed we would wake up slow and get into the day easy and quiet. And this morning we all got up cheering and rocking and getting everything ready to go. It was the perfect way to start our day.
And just like all of us, really, for the first time since takeoff, we will hear from the astronauts who are on their way to the moon. Before all of that, the BBC News is read for us this morning by Tom Sanders.
Senior executives at Marks & Spencer have called on the Home Secretary and the Mayor of London to do more to tackle high street crime. An M&S store was among those targeted by teenagers during disturbances over the past few days in Clapham in London. Writing in the Daily Telegraph today, the firm's retail director warns of growing lawlessness, saying shoplifting and attacks on staff are becoming more brazen, more organised and more aggressive. Here's our political correspondent Katie Austin.
This is an unusual and strongly worded intervention from Marks & Spencer's retail director, Tinas Keeve. He says he keeps hearing crime is falling, but retail workers are seeing the opposite. Staff are on the receiving end of abuse and violence on a daily basis, and while the problem is worse in London, it is happening across the country. Mr. Keeve says retailers are powerless without a government seriously cracking down on crime and a mayor who prioritises effective policing. He calls for a stronger, faster and more consistent police response. A spokesperson for the Mayor of London, Sir Sadiq Khan, said he would continue working with the Met Police to tackle the issue. He is expected to meet senior figures from M&S soon. The Home Office said it was giving police stronger powers.
NASA's Artemis 2 mission has left Earth's orbit on the first crewed journey to the moon for more than 50 years. Overnight, the four astronauts on board the Orion spacecraft fired its engine to free the capsule from Earth's gravitational pull. Our science correspondent Palab Ghosh sent this report from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida.
We have the start of the translunar injection burn that will send the crew around the moon, the first humans to do so in over 50 years.
This was a key moment in the astronauts' historic voyage. The TLI burn has given the spacecraft the big push it needs to leave the Earth's orbit.
Velocity of the spacecraft ticking up, now over 23,900 miles per hour.
As Orion surges into deep space, the astronauts will see, through its windows, the Earth shrinking into a small blue and white marble, while the Moon grows from a bright disk into a heavily cratered world. On about the sixth day of the mission, as the spacecraft cruises beyond the Moon, the crew are expected to witness a total solar eclipse from deep space. The Moon will completely cover the Sun's bright face to reveal its normally concealed shimmering halo, with the Earth seen to one side. No wonder Jeremy Hansen, the Canadian astronaut on board Orion, said minutes after the TLI burn,
"Crew's feeling pretty good up here on our way to the moon. Humanity has once again shown what we are capable of."
Police forces are being offered specialist support from a new national democracy protection units to tackle the rising level of threats and abuse faced by MPs. There were nearly 1,000 reports of crimes against MPs last year, a figure that's more than doubled since 2019. Deputy Chief Constable Chris Barmer has been appointed to lead the unit, which will help with investigations and coordinate intelligence on threats to politicians.
I'm worried about the volume. I'm worried about the fact that it's both online and offline. I'm worried about particular targeting of certain groups. But it's not lost on me that these are not idle threats. Tragically, we've had two cases in recent memory where those threats have been carried out.
Donald Trump has fired his Attorney General, Pam Bondi, hours after releasing a statement saying she was doing a great job. He said she was moving to a new role in the private sector. From Washington, Ione Wells.
You might think, reading Donald Trump and Pam Bondi's statements on her firing, that nothing had been wrong. Mr. Trump said she was a loyal friend and a patriot. She said she was thrilled to be moving to a new role. But behind the scenes, there had been growing frustration at her handling of the Epstein files, which had become a political liability for the Trump administration. Donald Trump has tried to take control of the Department of Justice, even putting a picture of his face on the building here in Washington. He has called for investigations and prosecutions of several of his political foes, but he's been frustrated at the progress of some of these investigations.
100 experts in international law have warned of serious violations by the United States, Israel and Iran in the war in the Middle East. The academics and former government officials say the conduct and rhetoric of the US is profoundly concerning and in some instances could amount to war crimes. The White House said the US campaign was making the region safer and acting in the interests of the American people. A federal judge in the United States has dismissed claims by the actress Blake Lively that she was sexually harassed by her co-star Justin Baldoni on the set of the 2024 film It Ends With Us. The judge said Ms. Lively could still pursue other claims against Mr. Baldoni, including one that his production company retaliated against her after she'd complained. A civil trial is scheduled for next month. Thousands of Easter rail journeys will be disrupted by a shutdown on the West Coast Main Line that begins today. The closure is part of a £400 million upgrade, as Mark Ashdown reports.
Totalling around 1,000 miles of track, the West Coast Main Line is Europe's busiest mixed-use railway network. It carries around 40% of the UK's freight traffic and is used by millions of people a year to travel between London and cities such as Birmingham, Manchester, Glasgow and Edinburgh. But from today, there'll be no trains on a stretch of it between London Euston and Milton Keynes until next Thursday. There are also major engineering works planned around Preston and Carlisle. Passengers are advised to check for diversions and replacement buses. Network Rail said its engineers would carry out 270 projects across the UK over the weekend, but promised that the majority of the network would be open.
Mark Ashdown reporting.
Thanks, Tom. 6 minutes past, 7 minutes past six, sorry. Let's get our first look at the Easter weather. Ben Rich is in the Weather Centre for us. Morning, Ben.
Morning, Simon. Thank you very much. And good morning to you. Quite a mixed Easter weekend of weather, actually, I have to say. And probably the biggest feature will come on Saturday night. Storm Dave has been named by the Met Office. And this is going to particularly affect the northern half of the UK, North Wales, Northern England, Northern Ireland, Scotland. Some heavy rain, some heavy snow in the far northwest of Scotland and some gales. Could see wind gusts of 50 to 60, but maybe touching 90 miles per hour in the most exposed spot. So that is for Saturday night. That could cause some quite significant disruption. But let's focus on the day ahead. Good Friday, and it's a pretty cloudy start out there. Quite misty, murky, damp and drizzly as well. Across the southwest of England and the southeast of England, I think the cloud will struggle to break through today. So it's going to stay largely grey. Some spots of light rain and drizzle at times. Wales, the Midlands, eastern England, here the cloud should break, so by this afternoon I think we should be seeing a bit more in the way of sunshine and just the small chance of a shower. And then for Northern England and for Northern Ireland, we'll see some outbreaks of rain moving through during the morning into the early afternoon, but then things should brighten up later, so some sunny spells and still a few showers to take us towards the end of the day. For Scotland, it is a day of sunshine and showers. Early cloud should break quite quickly, so we'll see some sunny spells but some showers, which could be wintry over high ground in the north of Scotland. Temperatures north to south, 8 to 16 degrees. Mildest weather will be found down towards the south and the east. Tonight, under clear skies, it will get cold. There's likely to be a frost across parts of Northern Ireland and Scotland.
Thank you, Ben. It's just coming round to 9 minutes past six. Let's take a first look at this morning's papers and with the headline Faces of the Betrayed. The front page of the Daily Mirror this morning features images of some of those whose remains were not properly handled by Robert Bush, an undertaker in Hull, who admitted more than 30 charges against him in court yesterday. The Daily Mail says it's feared thousands of families may have fallen victim to what the paper describes as Britain's most evil funeral director, while the Daily Express highlights calls for him to rot in jail when he's sentenced in July.
The Times says the Energy Secretary, Ed Miliband, is expected to approve the first major North Sea oil and gas project in almost a decade as ministers face pressure to increase drilling during the war against Iran. Separately, the Daily Telegraph notes what it calls a rare attack on Donald Trump by the Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, after she accused the US president of making a mess in the Middle East and criticised what she said was his lack of a coordinated plan.
The Guardian this morning says the property developer Nick Candy has sold his mansion in Chelsea for a reported £275 million in a transaction described by the paper as the most expensive on record in London and one of the biggest in the world. Mr Candy, who is the honorary treasurer of Reform UK and a major donor to the party as well, has declined to comment. The identity of the buyer has also not been made public.
And a fault with a toilet on board NASA's Orion spacecraft is the main news for The Sun, which calls the problem one giant leak for mankind. But the Daily Star says fears that the astronauts had nowhere to boldly go were resolved when the Artemis II mission control in Houston gave them instructions on how to mend it. According to The Times, crowds were left in awe by the launch of Orion when it blasted off from Florida yesterday. The paper picks out the emotional response of the BBC science editor, our own Rebecca Morell, saying she addressed viewers with tears in her eyes in a reaction that soon went viral.
Yeah, it is brilliant. If you haven't seen it yet, well recommended. It's 6:10 now.
Pam Bondi, as you were hearing in the headlines, Donald Trump's pugnacious Attorney General, has been fired. Donald Trump described her as a patriot and a loyal friend, but said she will be transitioning to a new role in the private sector, a move she says she's thrilled at. Before we discuss that in a bit more detail, here's a reminder of Bondi's distinctive style as she took on Democrat lawmakers at a hearing over the Epstein files last month.
Excuse me, I'm going to answer the question.
Answer my question.
No, I'm going to answer the question the way I want to answer the question.
No, you're going to answer the question the way I asked it.
Chairman Jordan, I'm not going to get in the gutter with these people, but I'm going to answer the question.
How many of you indicted?
Pam Bondi there. Well, earlier I spoke to Sibi Jaloso and our foreign affairs correspondent who told me a bit more about the former Attorney General.
She was basically the top dog at the Department of Justice and a staunch ally of President Trump. Before she became more active in national politics, she worked with the president's legal team during his first impeachment trial back in 2020.
Do we know why she's been fired?
On the surface, it seems quite amicable. It's not quite clear why President Trump has fired her. I mean, she's remained publicly beside the president in recent days. Just over the last week, he even called her a wonderful person and said that she's doing a good job. But the reality is there was a lot of tension within the Department of Justice, which she was leading. Her time in office was overshadowed by her handling of the release of the files related to the Jeffrey Epstein investigation, which sort of became a political liability for President Trump. It drummed up suspicion amongst his supporters. It brought scrutiny from Congress. So there was a lot of tension while she was in the role. And then there were questions over her handling of an investigation into the shooting of two US citizens back in January. And lastly, there was the issue of her pursuing criminal investigations into political opponents of President Trump. President Trump pressed Pam Bondi to do those investigations quicker and more aggressively, but clearly it wasn't quick or aggressive enough for him.
Simi Jolo-Osho, our foreign affairs correspondent, many thanks.
6:13, police forces are being offered specialist support from a new unit that is being set up to deal with the rising level of abuse and threats that are facing MPs. Well, Joshua Nevitt, our reporter, can tell us a little more. What will this unit look like? How will it work?
Morning, Anna. Well, the Democracy Protection Portfolio is essentially a unit that will sit within the National Police Chiefs Council, which is an organisation that brings together leaders from forces across the UK. It's being led by a police chief called Chris Barmer, whose brief is to basically help forces investigate and tackle what's known as anti-democratic crimes. Now, that could be anything from abuse or death threats on social media to more complex crimes such as transnational repression directed by hostile foreign states. And in this role, Chris Barmer will do things like coordinate intelligence on threats to MPs and provide specialist support to officers investigating alleged offences. So it's a national role that will seek to make the response to these crimes more effective, but local forces will ultimately retain operational responsibility for protecting MPs.
Right. And we said those crimes are on the rise. What do the numbers show us?
So reports of crimes against MPs have more than doubled since 2019, reaching 1,000 last year. There's been quite a marked rise in death threats. So in 2024, there was about 30, and that rose to 50 in 2025. And, you know, this democracy portfolio was only set up a few weeks ago, so it will take time for this to bed in. But I think many MPs will feel reassured that local forces are getting extra support to deal with more complex crimes. MPs told me that death threats have become commonplace, almost happening on a daily basis, and many are not reported to police. But equally, I think many MPs will be sceptical about what one police chief and his colleagues could reasonably achieve in this space, given the scale and the nature of the abuse and threats. In terms of physical threats, you know, we've seen security measures to protect MPs expanded significantly since the murder of Joe Cox in 2016. So speak to MPs and they'll tell you the security presence in their constituencies is keenly felt and much appreciated, but extra security and appointing a police chief to lead a new unit doesn't necessarily stop people making threats online.
Joshua Nevitt, thank you. We'll get the thoughts of Kim Leadbeater after 7 o'clock. You heard Joshua mention Jo Cox, Kim Leadbeater's sister. You remember Jo Cox was murdered in Birstall in her constituency. So we'll see what Kim Leadbeater thinks about those new proposals. She'll be with us in about an hour.
Just gone 6:15. Let's get some business news and an update from Tesla. Felicity Hannah has more. Morning, Felicity.
Morning. Yes, that's right. So Tesla missed expectations for deliveries in its first quarter. It delivered more than 358,000 cars in the 3 months. It was a 6% rise year on year, but demand was weaker than expected and left it with more than 50,000 unsold units. Let's talk to Peter Bardenfleth-Hansen, who worked for Tesla for 10 years as head of business development for Europe, the Middle East and Africa. Peter, good morning.
Morning.
So sales up year on year, but demand lower than expected. Is this a good or a bad result for Tesla?
I would say it's a mediocre result.
Ouch.
On the one hand, it definitely shows that Tesla are still in the game. And for first time in 5 quarters, they are actually retaining the lead of being a EV in manufacturer from BYD, who for the past year have actually been producing more than Tesla. On the other hand, the numbers are quite weak. They're definitely not showing the type of increase that one would have expected. So there are some worrying sights here. And there are also parts of this showcases there. The battery storage systems, which was down 40%, which has been sort of their secret golden goose in the background. Every time there was something not going right with the sales of vehicles, they'd been able to say, well, we're actually doing extremely well on the storage business. But that's actually also falling. So there are some worrying signs.
So is this a story of cheaper competitors taking market share or consumers cutting back or maybe even Elon Musk becoming a more politicized figure?
I think it's all of the above. There's no doubt if we look at the European numbers that the political affiliations that Elon has been flirting with has had a very negative effect on car sales. But there's also obviously the geopolitical situation globally has had an impact on EVs in general. However, I would say that the rise of competitors out there has been growing quite significantly, and what they've been able to offer, both in relation to battery types, equipment, self-driving capabilities, and so forth, is much, much higher than what Tesla would have expected. So they're being disrupted by being the disruptor, but now they're being disrupted by their competitors.
And yet, sales in Europe were picking up towards the end of the quarter, rising slightly in February and March, which does suggest the decline is turning around.
It does to a certain extent. There's absolutely no doubt that the current situation with rising oil, petrol prices is driving people to build and buy more EVs. So that's something that's definitely playing into the hands of the likes of Tesla.
Okay.
So I think we're definitely going to see some rises coming over the next year.
And speaking of rises, we've also heard that Elon Musk's SpaceX is set to go public in a $1 trillion share listing. Will that listing, explode?
I think, explode in a good way. I think it's going to be interesting to see. But he's really, again, disrupting a market that hasn't been touched before. So I think all good things are going to come out of that from a financial perspective.
Peter, we didn't even get to talk about robo-taxis and robots, but thank you very much indeed for joining us. That's Peter Bardenfleth-Hansen there, who formerly worked at Tesla. And listening to that is Lucy Coutts, Investment Director at the brokers JM Finn. Lucy, morning. What's your take then on that story about SpaceX potentially going public?
Well, I mean, it's great news. I mean, there's going to be a very small amount of shares, which we call on the free float, where they're accessible by retail investors. So the control remains very much with Elon. But the target sort of market cap is going to be $1.75 trillion, which puts it at the sixth largest company in the US, which is incredible. And you know, while we know SpaceX builds and flies rockets and spacecraft and satellite networks, it does actually provide component parts for Artemis. And when it does land on the moon, I think it's in its fourth iteration, then one of those parts will be built by SpaceX, which is a great combination.
And people get very excited about space. Let's also talk, though, about what we're seeing with the Iran war. President Donald Trump has made fresh threats on Iranian infrastructure in a new social media post. He said the US military hasn't even started destroying what's left in Iran, adding that Iranian bridges are next, then electric power plants. What kind of impact does that kind of statement have on the price of commodities and on the price of oil?
Well, I mean, we went into, I think it was Wednesday evening, expecting Donald Trump to come out with some sort of statement which would give certainty and perhaps a pathway to resolving this. But actually, he's extended the length of the war. There's no plan to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, told allies to get their own oil, and warned, as you say, of further strikes. So this actually impacted the oil price significantly yesterday. It rose 8%, which is a record. And this actually translates into price rises at the fuel pumps, which we're all seeing. And it certainly impacts significantly on the UK because we're more reliant on diesel imports. Mm-hmm. But markets are concerned about the expected length of this war and when is it going to end and when is the uncertainty going to end.
And the Bank of England's latest decision maker panel survey showed British companies expect to raise prices more quickly in the next 12 months as they respond to those rising energy prices due to the Iran war. Lucy Coutts from JM Finn, thank you very much indeed. Now, not every business is seeing demand being hit by the conflict. The boss of the world's biggest fibre optic cable maker, Prysmian, says the US-Israel war is forcing countries to think about becoming more self-sufficient and less reliant on oil. Now, the company designs, produces, installs and repairs those critical undersea telecoms and energy cables across the UK, Europe and the USA. And I spoke to Prysmian's chief executive, Massimo Battaini, and I started off by asking him exactly how his business actually installs those cables deep under the sea.
You have vessels that can lay cables, and while they lay cable, the same vessel pull a plow, so tools that create a trench on the seabed, and the cables fall in this trench, and then the plow close the trench with the rocks and other stuff from the seabed. So cables are buried for security reasons, so that they are not damaged by anchor, by fisherman stuff. They are not even damaged by sabotage because it's difficult to find where they are. And more customers asking us to improve the burial depth of cable laying in seabed position to guarantee more security.
Talk to me about the war in Iran. Is that having a direct impact on your business?
It will have an impact across the board because the cost of oil and gas soaring will create additional cost in raw material.
Do you know how much?
Yeah, so we, for the time being, we've seen a 2 or 3 percentage point increase in some of the raw material. I think what matters would be what would be relevant to understand the duration of this war. Now, if this were something like the Ukraine war, we have seen inflationary impact across across everything for 1 year and a half. I don't think this war will last that long. And so I think, according to what we hear from the U.S. administration, things should resolve the next few weeks. I hope we can trust this administration. I hope they're right. But yeah, there's been some inflationary impact happening already.
When you think about your own balance sheet and the enormous multi-billion dollar projects that you work on, a rise of 2 to 3%, inflation in your costs must be really significant. Do you know what this might potentially mean for your books?
We are in a market whereby in terms of contracts, existing contracts and new contract frame agreement with customer, we tend to have the possibility to pass the cost to the market. Now, we had the same situation in 21, 22 as a reflection of the Ukrainian war. So we pass this on to the customer, which is not nice, I understand, but those are temporary situations. On the other hand, we work a lot in innovation to reduce the cost for customers. So a couple of weeks ago, we presented a breakthrough innovation in energy segment in the transmission space. We develop a solution, a cable that can transmit 20% more power for same cost.
So has the conflict, in fact, made your clients even more anxious to invest in cables to build that resilience?
I agree. I mean, this is actually giving us an upside because people want to rely less on oil and they want to rely less on gas and oil coming from other regions. So geopolitical tension is playing a significant role in forcing every region to become more self-sufficient. And the main way to do it is to invest in renewable.
The world is getting noisier, isn't it? We've got increased friction for trade, with tariffs from the White House. We've got growing conflict. We've got what's going on in the Middle East, the ongoing war in Ukraine. There's a huge number of pressures on a company like yours, but 2025 was your best year yet. How do you think 2026 is going to look?
But first of all, let me to say that we like this type of environment. It's extremely dynamic, it's extremely volatile to a certain extent, and it puts a lot of pressures. But, we are the only global one. We are the main player in this space in energy and telecom cables. We are global, and we like this geopolitical tension. We like this continuous pressure because we can leverage the global footprint to weather the risk in some countries, some regions, and maximize the opportunity. And innovation remains our main asset to maintain this global footprint active and effective. Flexibility is extremely important these days because, as you said correctly, there were tariffs last year, then geopolitical tension, reshoring of manufacturing plant, data center, AI. And by the way, there is a new trend. There is fiber application for drones, for military application that has reshaped the fiber demand worldwide. So things are happening very fast. We are global and we can react with a lot of agility and flexibility. This is what characterizes our company, with innovation, agility and flexibility.
Massimo Battaini there, CEO of Prysmian.
Thank you, Fliss. 27 minutes past six. Time for the sport. Jonathan Ledyard is here. Good morning.
Morning. You sound surprised.
I'm pleased. I'm delighted. what that sound was.
I am slightly surprised because it's barely spring, but we're going to have the first sounds of summer today, I think, because it's the start of the Cricket County Championship. And after England's humiliating Ashes defeat over the winter, the national team management have been making moves to reconnect with the county game. It was revealed yesterday that coach Brendan McCullum and director of cricket Rob Key held a call with county cricket head coaches and directors on Wednesday. Among those on the call was Peter Moores, head coach of defending county champions Nottinghamshire.
It was more a chance for, I think, for Rob, Brendan and some of the staff to just tell all the coach at the same time what they're looking for and a little bit of where they see the sort of players they're going to be looking for coming forward. So I think the key here is that every player in the country is excited about playing for their country, and at times it has felt a little bit like the route to England hasn't been as straightforward as it should be. If you're playing really good cricket and somebody isn't doing so well, then you get a chance to get a go in there.
Moores also praised the England opener Ben Duckett last night for prioritising his county form in red ball and the long form cricket ahead of white ball riches at the Indian Premier League. And a former England opener and captain, Sir Alistair Cook, predicts a thrilling opening to the season because so many players will be looking to prove a point to the selectors.
I think the next 3 months is going to be really exciting for county cricketers because I think there's a fair few slots, in particular opening batsmen, the wicketkeeper, probably the bowling attack as well, where you could get any number of combinations. So actually performances for once now will have consequence, I believe, in county cricket.
But there was a strong warning last night from the Sussex director of cricket, Paul Farbrace, that those counties not hosting international cricket face a very uncertain future.
You have to have a business acumen. You have to make money away from just county cricket because, you know, the smaller clubs, they make no money whatsoever on county cricket. You probably lose money every time you open the gates. And now with T20, we're down to 6 home games. We only make money at Sussex 6 times a year. So unless we qualify for a home quarter final, and we did that 2 years ago, we halved our debt that year. And that, you know, brought us in about 130 grand.
So tough times wherever you are in cricket, but let's see how this season unfolds. Every ball of every county championship match is live on the BBC Sport website and app, plus via BBC Sounds. And one other story from last night, Barcelona produced a stunning display to thump rivals Real Madrid 6-0 in the Women's Champions League. That was a 12-2 aggregate win, which sets up a semi-final against Bayern Munich. Holders Arsenal learnt that they're going to play the 8 times winners Lyon in the other semi-final after the French side overturned a 1-0 deficit from the first leg.
I know the weather's always dreadful whenever the cricket season starts. Storm Dave coming in just right on cue.
And of course, you know, it's beautiful weather for the start of the football season in August.
Thanks, Jonathan.
We must start at the beginning. On BBC iPlayer, to be poor and handsome is misfortune enough, but to be penniless and plain is a hard fate indeed.
Starring Ruth Jones and Richard E. Grant.
We shall all go to the ball, as long as I am obliged to hear no more about it.
4 good marriages will have to do.
I only hope she does not ruin her sister's chances.
The other Bennett sister.
Is it possible you'll ever find a way to fit in?
Watch on BBC iPlayer.
29 minutes to 7, you're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Simon Jack in London, Anna Foster in Salford, and Tom Sanders has a summary of the news.
Executives at Marks & Spencer have called for the government and the Mayor of London to do more to combat high street crime. They say shoplifting and attacks on staff are becoming more brazen, more organised and more aggressive. The Home Office said it was giving police stronger powers. A spokesperson for the Mayor, Sir Sadiq Khan, said he would continue working with officers to tackle the issue. NASA's Artemis 2 mission has left the Earth's orbit and is heading for the moon. The crew fired the engine of their spacecraft to send it on the next stage of its voyage. The 4 astronauts are due to travel further from the Earth than anyone has been before. They said the views of their home planet were spectacular and described being glued to the window as they took photos. A new National Democracy Protection Unit will support police forces in tackling the rising level of threats and abuse faced by MPs. A senior officer has been appointed to coordinate intelligence and help with investigations. MPs say threats against their lives have become commonplace and many aren't reported to police. President Trump has sacked Pam Bondi from her position as US Attorney General. She's been criticised for her handling of the release of the files relating to the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The position will be temporarily filled by Mr. Trump's former personal lawyer, Todd Blanche. More than 100 legal experts in the United States have signed an open letter expressing profound concern about what they see as serious violations of international law by the United States, Israel and Iran in the Middle East war. The White House said President Trump had made important national security decisions. Thousands of Easter rail journeys will be disrupted by a shutdown on the West Coast Main Line that begins today. The closure between London Euston and Milton Keynes is to allow for upgrade works.
Thanks, Tom. As you were hearing there, Marks and Spencer bosses have written to both the Mayor of London, Sir Sadiq Khan, and Home Secretary Shaban Mahmood, pleading for them to do more to tackle what they call routine and brazen shoplifting and assaults on staff. Jack Fenwick is our political correspondent here in the studio with me. Morning, Jack. Quite a strongly worded letter. Take us through it.
Yeah, this, of course, follows those disturbances involving young people in the Clapham area of South London earlier this week. One of the shops it's targeted was an M&S store. As you say, executives have written to both the Home Secretary and the Mayor of London. And the company's retail director, Tinas Keeve, has also written for the Telegraph newspaper. Now, he says that colleagues are on the end of abuse and violence every day. He says the problem is worse in London, but that it's happening across the country. There's some quite striking detail in this letter. He says in the past week alone, we've had gangs forcing open locked cabinets and stripping shelves. He said a large group of young people were ransacking a store before assaulting a security guard. He said one colleague had been headbutted, another had had ammonia thrown in their face. In terms of what M&S are actually calling for, they say it's effectively about doing more to help the police out. They talk about giving them more support, more resources, working with retailers closer, and crucially, sharing data. He says that he keeps hearing that crime is going down, but says that people working in retail simply don't see that.
And what kind of response have they got?
So we've had a response from the spokesperson for the Mayor of London. They said that shoplifting's not a victimless crime. They said they're putting more money into neighbourhood policing, but that they know there is more to do. We understand that there will soon be a meeting between the Mayor and M&S. The Crime and Policing Minister, Sarah Jones, has said this mindless behaviour has no place in our society. They say they're giving police stronger powers. Now, interestingly, when Labour first came to power, this whole area was the thing the Home Office spoke most about. That's actually not the case anymore. Mm. Immigration seemed to sort of somewhat replace it as the main topic. But I've been in the sort of focus groups that the government take big notice of. And this issue of high streets and crime is something that comes up time and again.
And there was, at one stage, they were anything under £200 was deprioritised. And that's actually been reversed now, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And this is the sort of thing that we were hearing sort of Labour talk a lot about. It's sort of back end of 2024, early 2025. With incidents like this and with what is a pretty unusual intervention from M&S, clearly they want ministers to be talking about that sort of thing more again.
OK, Jack, thanks very much indeed. And we will be talking to a senior executive from M&S just after the 7 o'clock news. Thank you.
It's 24 minutes to 7 now. President Trump has promised much more to follow in his words after the US struck the largest bridge in Iran. Overnight, there's been incoming fire in Israel, reports of attacks in the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain again. State media in Kuwait say that an oil refinery there has been hit. Well, let's get the latest from our Middle East correspondent, Yolande Nell. Yolande, what do we know about what is being targeted in Iran by the US and Israel?
Well, a few days ago, the Israeli military was saying to the media, through the different unnamed officials, that they had worked their way through military sites and were now looking at, you know, economic sites, sites that would really target the regime, put pressure on it to agree to a deal. And in recent days, the US and Israel have really stepped up their attacks on infrastructure. So we saw this bridge that was targeted near the capital. There's really dramatic footage showing that these large explosions as it was hit and collapsed. And people have been picnicking along the riverside there, the Iranian authorities say, for the end of the Persian New Year holidays, and they're saying that 8 people were killed and close to 100 people were injured. This, of course, comes, you know, we had President Trump threatening to bomb Iran back to the Stone Ages over the next 2 to 3 weeks, and he's put out a post on his social media platform, Truth Social, overnight, saying, you know, bridges next, then electric power plants, suggesting that there could be more civilian infrastructure that is targeted. Of course, they're saying that this is sort of dual use, that it is also key to the Iranian regime. But there are dozens of international law experts in the US that have signed this open letter saying that US strikes on Iran may amount to war crimes because, of course, the 1949 Geneva Convention says that prohibits attacks on sites which are basically considered essential for civilians. And we know also in recent days there's been something put up on his X account by the Iranian president, Masoud Pezeshkian, saying there's been an attack on a public health center, the Pasteur Institute in Iran. There have been attacks on other sort of medical sites where the Israelis and the Americans are claiming there's intelligence that they were, you know, they were for dual use. They were also being used by the regime.
And also, we know more attacks by Iran on Israel overnight, Gulf states as well. That is still happening.
That's right. And it just shows that Iran still does have this ability to strike its neighbours, to strike Israel further away. So there was a drone attack on Kuwait's national oil company. The reports from there saying that that has caused several fires that they have been trying to put out. There's an Iranian cluster missile that was fired at central Israel. There's lots of sites around Tel Aviv. There are not reports of injuries. It seems this missile was not intercepted, but you know, there's pictures that show that there are cars and streets and houses that have been damaged. And the Revolutionary Guard Corps in Iran has also been claiming attacks in the past day on a data center for the US tech firm Oracle in Dubai, for the Amazon Cloud Computing Center in Bahrain as well.
Yolan, thank you. That's Yolan Nell, our Middle East correspondent.
Let us cast our thoughts to the heavens. Artemis 2 is on track for the moon after successfully firing a key thruster to alter its course and push it out of Earth's orbit. The four astronauts on board the Orion spacecraft have also been speaking overnight. Here's mission commander Reid Wiseman.
There was a moment about an hour ago where Mission Control Houston reoriented our spacecraft as the sun was setting behind the Earth. And I don't know what we all expected to see in that moment, but you could see the entire globe from pole to pole. You could see Africa, Europe, and if you looked really close, you could see the northern lights. It was the most spectacular moment, and it paused all four of us in our tracks.
An upbeat crew there. Let's talk to Palab Ghosh, our science correspondent. Morning, Palab. Just take us through, what stage are we at now?
The astronauts are on their way to the moon. That's what we're at. And that view that Commander Wiseman was talking about is a view that people haven't seen for more than 50 years, because you don't get that view from the International Space Station. It's too close to Earth. And as they move, as they hurtle towards the moon, because they have done a big burn that's increased the speed of their spacecraft, the Earth is going to get smaller and smaller so that it looks like a marble, a jeweled marble in space. And the moon, rather than being a featureless disk to them, is going to look like a cratered world. They're going to see fine details and details that no one has seen before. And on the as it goes around the moon on the on Monday, probably, they're going to see a total solar eclipse from space with Earth in the background. So we are going to see all the things the astronauts see, and we're going to be in for a treat, Simon.
Yeah. And when they get round the other side, how long is this going to take? Because I think a lot of us think once you're in the atmosphere, the Earth's atmosphere, if you're in orbit where all the satellites are, it's only a hop, skip and a jump to the moon, but it's actually quite a long way.
They'll get to the moon on Monday. So it's a few days, which is a long time. But they're on this. They're basically falling. They've done their main engine burn, which has given the Orion spacecraft enough energy to leave the Earth's immediate orbit. But they're not going to fire their engines anymore, apart from a few course corrections. What's going to happen is they're going to swing all the way around the moon, go around the far side, where there's going to be this kind of nerve-wracking communications loss for 40 minutes or so. They're going to emerge from the other side and come back to Earth. They will see things that the Apollo astronauts have not seen before. But the main part of this mission is to test the spacecraft and test the crew and to improve the performance of all these things in time for an eventual lunar landing in 2028. And this time, rather than just go to the moon a few times, what the Artemis program is all about is to keep returning to the moon, to build a moon base so that we can eventually live and work in space, just as people of my generation thought that we would when the Apollo program was there. But that got cancelled because the purpose of the Apollo program was to beat the Soviet Union. And once that had been done, they felt there was no need to continue.
Well, we'll be checking back in on their progress throughout the programme. For now, Palab, though, thanks very much indeed.
It is just coming round to 18 minutes to 7 now. A couple of nuggets from inside the papers for you this morning. The Eye talks about teachers being opposed to a ban on library books. This is an end to censorship in school libraries amid fears that some of the classic books are being banned because of the content that they have in them. So delegates at the National Education Union Conference in Brighton have voted to oppose censorship. This is after claims that one school in Salford ordered more than 130 books to be removed altogether because of what was in them. Also, the Times this morning, page 3 of the Times, steel yourself for this one. Harvard University has come out with a new study that says that when a male octopus is looking for a mate, they have discovered that it has a probing arm, it's described as here, which actually tastes potential mates and decides which one is right and appropriate based on their flavour. It has a special name as well, this specialised limb. It's called the hectocoitalis. So there you go, you see. You're informed more than you were 5 minutes ago.
Tiptoed very delicately through that one. Well
done. I did, didn't I?
Yeah, you did. The Times also caught my eye this morning on the front page. Miliband set to back North Sea gas field is their headline. And this is, they're saying that Ed Miliband will give the green light to Jackdaw, which is a large gas field off the coast of Scotland. The project's been waiting for Mr. Miliband's approval since 2024, after the High Court ruled that a previous licence it was granted was invalid because it hadn't taken into account the carbon emissions that burning the gas would produce. One source, they quote, says Miliband was under intense pressure to greenlight this and a further one called Rosebank at a time of growing focus on the UK's energy security. Tessa Khan is quoted here. She's the executive director of Uplift, which campaigns against further drilling, saying it would have zero impact on our energy bills and do precious little to increase gas supply. We'll be talking to a man who led BP for over a decade a little bit later in the programme.
It is just coming round to 6:45 now.
After 5 years of harsh military rule, Myanmar gets a new president today, and he's not really new. General Min Aung Hlaing is the man who led the 2021 coup against the elected government led by Aung San Suu Kyi. He'll be selected to lead the new notionally civilian administration by a parliament packed with military men and loyalists. The move is widely seen as an attempt by the military regime, which has been internationally ostracised, to win more legitimacy. However, the civil war ignited by the coup continues, with daily airstrikes carried out against the large areas of Myanmar under the control of opposition forces. Our Southeast Asia correspondent Jonathan Head had just been to Myanmar to watch the last military parade presided over by Min Aung Hlaing before he gave up command of the armed forces.
On a vast parade ground overlooked by towering statues, thousands of soldiers march with impressive precision in front of their commander-in-chief. He's an unprepossessing figure, short and stout with blinking, bespectacled eyes. Yet today, General Min Aung Hlaing is by far the most powerful man in Myanmar, despite having led a catastrophic coup that tipped his country into civil war and being accused in international courts of genocide and crimes against humanity. They hold this parade every year in the strange citadel-like capital of Naypyidaw. It's a reminder to the people of Myanmar of the tenacious hold the military has had over their country for most of its modern history. The formidable weaponry on display, also a reminder of how much this regime has been propped up by support from Russia and China. But this is the last time Min Aung Hlaing will preside over this. 5 years after his coup, he's hanging up his uniform to become a civilian president. His final speech to the troops was as unyielding and unapologetic as all the others he's given here. The military has a constitutional right to get involved in politics, he said, and he dismissed those who've taken up arms against his regime as terrorists, led on by what he called foreign aggressors. There wasn't a hint of regret over the thousands of lives lost because of the coup. Jorwin, not his real name, was a student when he was arrested for taking part in a small flash mob protest in Yangon 3 years ago. He describes days of torture in the interrogation centre. They beat me with iron bars, he told me. They burnt me with cigarettes, slashed my leg with a knife, and sexually assaulted me. Only recently released from prison, he said he's had enough and wants to leave Myanmar. Thousands of other young people have already gone.
If I stay in this country, I will always face all kinds of oppression. There is forced conscription that really worries me. We are under constant surveillance. I love my family. I want to stay with them. But going overseas is now the best option for me.
Dinzhar Shunlei made that decision a few months after the coup. As an organiser of the movement resisting military rule, there was already an arrest warrant out for her. From exile, she's kept up her campaign to restore democracy, and she's not impressed by Min Aung Hlaing in civilian guise.
He cannot credibly present himself as a legitimate president. He is not my president. He is not our president. For many people in Myanmar, this is not a transition to democracy, but simply an attempt to normalize impunity they have long been enjoying in Myanmar.
Well, unlike the villages in Myanmar's contested areas, you don't really see the impact of the war in Myanmar's cities like Yangon, but people here are definitely feeling it. Rapid inflation, businesses closing down. I'm in the factory district of Lang Tyre. It's Sunday and the workers who live here are all dressed in their colourful finest, waiting for buses to take them to parks or pagodas to spend their day off. So let's ask them what they expect of their new notionally civilian government.
They won't care about us, said this motorbike taxi driver. We'll still have to rely on ourselves. With the fuel shortages caused by the Iran war, he complained that his earnings no longer covered even his food and rent. Like so many who've not fled overseas, he said all he could do was try to survive while waiting to see whether anything will change when the same military men remain in charge.
As Jonathan Head reporting, it is 10 to 7 now. Iran's Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi says striking civilian structures will not compel Iranians to surrender. It is still unclear when the war might end, with attacks continuing and, of course, the ongoing damage to infrastructure and the global economy, as well as people's lives as well, the impact on those. Well, Mehran Kamrava is a professor at Georgetown University in Qatar and Iranian Studies Unit at the Arab Centre for Research and Policy Studies. Good morning.
Good morning.
Abbas Araghchi was referring in particular to the bridge which was attacked by the US in Iran, still under construction, but civilian infrastructure. How do you think that Iran will respond to that particular attack?
Well, it only justifies Iranian attacks on civilian targets across the Persian Gulf, particularly in places like Bahrain, United Arab Emirates, and Kuwait. And these are places where, according to the Iranians, American military personnel either frequent or are staying at. And then, of course, what the Iranians are doing somewhat meticulously is to document these for future reference as war crimes.
Is there a sense that there is a mirroring of infrastructure being targeted in Iran by the US and Israel, then being targeted? So we've seen, haven't we, then being targeted by Iran in Gulf states, for example, because we've seen desalination plants, oil storage and production facilities. Is there a sense that Iran is deliberately doing that, copying the places that are attacked on its own soil?
Yes. With international law in the back of their mind, at least an interpretation of international law, Iran is concerned about what is called proportionality. So this tit for tat in terms of one infrastructure for another. Although we have not yet seen extensive Iranian attacks on civilian infrastructures and specifically on water desalination plant. That would be, in many ways, the nuclear option for Iran, because the countries here in the region rely almost 100% on desalinated water, and that would escalate the conflict to a completely new level.
You mentioned war crimes. It's something that people are increasingly talking about. And we keep hearing it from both sides, actually, as a pushback to that, that these are dual-use infrastructure. Yes, they're civilian, but that they have benefit to the military as well. How compelling is that as an argument, do you think?
Well, the mentioning these infrastructures as dual-use, for example, a bridge, which the Iranians were incredibly proud of, And it was a bridge that was taught in universities in Iran as because of its pioneering engineering techniques. I'm not sure if that would be considered a dual-use infrastructure. And we have it in writing as well as in saying that President Trump says we're going to go after not just bridges, but also electric power plants. And in that sense, I don't think there's any lack or any doubt here that he's openly advocating committing war crimes.
It becomes a tricky argument on both sides, doesn't it, as they look at what they're targeting and what they aren't. Mehram Kamrava, thank you for joining us, professor at Georgetown University in Qatar.
6 minutes to seven, a new National Democracy Protection Unit is being set up to deal with the rising level of threats and abuse facing MPs. It'll help forces investigate and tackle those crimes, which have more than doubled since 2019 and reached almost 1,000 last year. Kim Leadbeater is the Labour MP for Spen Valley. Her sister, of course, Jo Cox, was killed in 2016 in her constituency, Batley and Spen, as it was then. Good morning to you, Kim.
Good morning.
I mean, obviously that tragic moment was a moment of reckoning when people looked at this. I just wonder how you think it's evolved in the 10 years now since that happened.
Well, look, it felt like a moment of reckoning, but I have to say I'm spending a lot of time at the moment planning for the 10th anniversary of Jo's murder and reflecting a lot on what's happened in the last 10 years. And sadly, I think when it comes to civility in public life, we're probably in a worse place than we were then. And I think what we also have to acknowledge is that this is a political problem. It's a problem for our democracy. But I do think there's a broader problem for society as well in terms of how we are able to listen to each other, how we are able to express our views and our opinions in a civilised, respectful manner. And where we do disagree, how we can disagree well and respectfully. It's interesting that one of your other stories this morning is about abuse and violence towards shop workers. And I find it really concerning that whatever job you're doing, you just want to go to work and feel safe. And if we're saying that we can't, you know, even have retail staff going to work and feeling safe, then we have to look at the kind of society we have and the kind of society that we want to have. And part of that is politics, but part of it is our communities more broadly as well, I think.
Well, what about setting up a National Democracy Protection Unit? What do you make of these attempts?
Well, I think it's really sad that the conclusion is that that's needed. No MP I know, no councillor I know wants to be wrapped in cotton wool and doesn't want to see people and meet the public. And we're very lucky in this country. If we look at the state of the world at the moment, we've got democracy. We've got easy access to our elected representatives. And I don't think anybody wants to change that. But we've seen MPs' offices attacked. You know, we've seen MPs themselves, as we know, attacked physically and the loss of obviously my sister Jo, but also Sir David Amos in 2021. So we have to do something, because if not, what will happen? We will lose good people from public life because they don't feel safe. And we will stop good people wanting to enter public life because of the risks involved with that. And that does have a deep impact on our democracy. Yeah. But we have to look at the solutions, Simon, because the other thing is, I've been saying this for 10 years now, as have lots of other people, but we have to look at the role that politicians themselves have in changing the culture, because we see some pretty poor behaviour at times from people who work in politics. Yeah. We have to look at what the media can do and how we can cover stories in a balanced manner that doesn't always look at the polarised opinions that some people might have, because actually 9 times out of 10, that's not where most people are. Yeah. We have to look at social media and the clear role that that plays in misinformation and disinformation. And we have to look at personal responsibility for every single one of us, thinking before we might say something, looking at whether we're basing what we're saying on facts and truths and those sorts of things, and just basically how we treat our fellow human beings. You know, how sad is it that we go to a hospital these days and there's signs up basically saying, please be nice to the staff? When did that change?
OK, well, you're calling for a very fundamental societal shift there. But Kim Leadbeater, thanks very much indeed for talking to us this morning. MP for Spen Valley, of course, sister to Jo Cox, who was murdered 10 years ago now.
It is just a couple of minutes to seven. Let's check the weather with Ben Rich.
Anna, thank you very much. Good morning to you. A pretty grey and gloomy start to this Good Friday morning. There is a lot of cloud around, some mist and murk for western coasts and hills, and some spots of light rain and drizzle. Now, for many of us, things will brighten up a little bit as the day goes on, but across the southwest of England and the southeast of England, I think it will be a struggle to break the cloud. So staying mostly cloudy, mostly grey, some spots of rain and drizzle at times. For Wales, for the Midlands, Midlands and for eastern England, a lot of grey and damp weather around as well. But by this afternoon, I'm hopeful that the cloud will thin and break to give some spells of sunshine. Now, for northern England and for Northern Ireland, we will see some outbreaks of rain moving through, particularly during the late morning into the early afternoon. But that rain should tend to clear to a mix of sunshine and showers this afternoon. And for Scotland, cloud breaking up quite quickly today to leave that mix of sunny spells and showers. Some of the showers will be wintry over high ground in the north of Scotland, and temperatures north to south today around 8 to 16 degrees. Tonight we'll see clear spells. It'll turn cold and frosty. Tomorrow, particularly by the end of the day, things are going to turn very wet and very windy as Storm Dave affects the northern half of the UK. And that is the forecast.
Now, to take us up to 7 o'clock, a verse of a Good Friday hymn.
It's 7 o'clock on Friday the 3rd of April. This is Today with Anna Foster in Salford and Simon Jack in London. The headlines. Marks and Spencer say retail crime is becoming more brazen, more organised and more aggressive. And it's accused the government and the Mayor of London of not doing enough to tackle it. The astronauts on NASA's Artemis 2 mission have left the Earth's orbit, bound for the far side of the moon. And police forces are being offered specialist help to deal with rising threats against MPs.
Also coming up in the next hour of the programme this morning, Reform UK's Robert Jenrick will join us to talk about why his party wants to now keep the triple lock. And
we all agree we would wake up slow and get into the day easy and quiet. And this morning we all got up cheering and rocking and getting everything ready to go. It was the perfect way to start our day.
Probably more impressive than most of us. But for the first time since takeoff, we will hear from the astronauts who are on their way to the moon. The BBC News is read by Tom Sanders.
Senior executives at Marks and Spencer have called on the Home Secretary and the Mayor of London to do more to tackle high street crime. An M&S store was among those targeted by teenagers during disturbances over the past few days in Clapham in London. Writing in the Daily Telegraph today, the firm's retail director warns of growing lawlessness, saying shoplifting and attacks on staff are becoming more brazen, more organised and more aggressive. Here's our political correspondent, Katie Austin.
This is an unusual and strongly worded intervention from Marks & Spencer's retail director, Tinas Keeve. He says he keeps hearing crime is falling, but retail workers are seeing the opposite. Staff are on the receiving end of abuse and violence on a daily basis, and while the problem is worse in London, it is happening across the country. Mr. Keeve says retailers are powerless without a government seriously cracking down on crime and a mayor who prioritises effective policing. He calls for a stronger, faster and more consistent police response. A spokesperson for the Mayor of London, Sir Sadiq Khan, said he would continue working with the Met Police to tackle the issue. He is expected to meet senior figures from M&S soon. The Home Office said it was giving police stronger powers.
NASA's Artemis 2 mission has left Earth's orbit on the first crewed journey to the moon for more than 50 years. Overnight, the four astronauts on board the Orion spacecraft fired its engine to free the capsule from Earth's gravitational pull. Our science correspondent Pallab Ghosh sent this report from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida.
We have the start of the translunar injection burn that will send the crew around the moon, the first humans to do so in over 50 years.
This was a key moment in the astronauts' historic voyage. The TLI burn has given the spacecraft the big push it needs to leave the Earth's orbit.
Velocity of the spacecraft ticking up, now over 23,900 miles per hour.
As Orion surges into deep space, the astronauts will see, through its windows, the Earth shrinking into a small blue and white marble, while the moon grows from a bright disk into a heavily cratered world. On about the sixth day of the mission, as the spacecraft cruises beyond the moon, the crew are expected to witness a total solar eclipse from deep space. The moon will completely cover the sun's bright face, to reveal its normally concealed shimmering halo, with the Earth seen to one side. No wonder Jeremy Hansen, the Canadian astronaut on board Orion, said minutes after the TLI burn,
"Crew's feeling pretty good up here on our way to the moon. Humanity has once again shown what we are capable of."
Police forces are being offered specialist support from a new National Democracy Protection Unit to tackle the rising level of threats and abuse faced by MPs. There were nearly 1,000 reports of crimes against MPs last year, a figure that's more than doubled since 2019. Our political reporter Joshua Nevitt has more details.
Security measures to protect MPs have been expanded substantially since the murder of Joe Cox in 2016, but many still feel unsafe and have urged the police to go further to protect them. MPs told the BBC that threats against their life had become commonplace and many weren't reported to police. In response to this, a police chief has been appointed to lead a new democracy protection portfolio. As part of this role, Deputy Chief Constable Chris Barmer will coordinate intelligence on threats to politicians and provide specialist support to officers investigating alleged offenders. He said forces had to be alive to the evolving threats facing MPs.
President Trump has said there's much more to follow after the US bombed Iran's largest bridge. Iranian state media says 8 people were killed. Iran and its proxies launched fresh strikes at targets in Israel and Gulf states overnight, including an oil refinery in Kuwait. With the latest on the conflict, here's our Middle East correspondent, Yolande Nell.
The US and Israel have stepped up their attacks on Iran's infrastructure. Iranian state media say many people were picnicking near the B-1 suspension bridge for the end of the Persian New Year holidays when it was hit by US warplanes. In a post on his Truth Social platform, President Trump wrote, "much more to follow," and later suggested electric power plants could be next. Iran has continued to show its ability to strike its neighbours overnight. A drone attack on Kuwait's national oil company is said to have caused several fires. An Iranian missile with a cluster warhead was fired at central Israel, damaging property at a number of sites, but with no reports of injuries.
The US Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has asked the Army Chief of Staff General Randy George to step down. Mr. Hegseth has sacked more than a dozen military leaders since taking office in January last year. Donald Trump has fired his Attorney General, Pam Bondi, hours after releasing a statement saying she was doing a great job. He said that she is moving to a new role in the private sector. Ms. Bondi has faced criticism for her handling of the release of files relating to the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. From Washington, Ione Wells.
You might think, reading Donald Trump and Pam Bondi's statements on her firing, that nothing had been wrong. Mr. Trump said she was a loyal friend and a patriot. She said she was thrilled to be moving to a new role. But behind the scenes, there had been growing frustration at her handling of the Epstein files, which had become a political liability for the Trump administration. There were also concerns about her performance and communication style when appearing at congressional hearings.
I'm going to answer the question.
Answer my question.
No, I'm going to answer the question the way I want to answer the question.
Donald Trump has tried to take control of the Department of Justice, even putting a picture of his face on the building here in Washington. He has called for investigations and prosecutions of several of his political foes, but he's been frustrated at the progress of some of these investigations.
An American congressman has accused the king of taking the legalistic way out after writing to ask him to meet survivors of Jeffrey Epstein during his state visit to the US later this month. It's understood there'll be no such meeting because of ongoing police investigations, including into Epstein's friendship with the king's brother, Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. Our correspondent John Sudworth reports.
Ro Khanna, a Democrat from California, has been one of the most prominent congressional voices pushing for transparency for Epstein's victims. His letter to King Charles called for him to meet them privately during his state visit later this month. But multiple press reports since claim there are no plans to do so, citing ongoing UK police investigations. In an interview on the BBC's Newsnight programme, Mr. Khanna dismissed that concern, saying it was likely raised by palace lawyers, and urged the king to instead put the survivors first.
The king has a clear choice. He's either going to listen to a bunch of lackeys and take a legalistic way out and have the monarchy have its heyday with Donald Trump obsessed about it and then start to lose credibility with the new generation in America, or he can do the right thing, meet with these survivors, and actually show that the British royalty and monarchy has some value in the modern world.
The former Prince Andrew has always denied any wrongdoing, but questions over his friendship with the convicted paedophile will make for a difficult backdrop to the four-day state visit, and there have also been calls for it to be postponed because of the ongoing conflict in the Middle East. But the visit is going ahead, with Mr. Trump posting, "It will be terrific."
A federal judge in the United States has dismissed claims by the actress Blake Lively that she was sexually harassed by her co-star Justin Baldoni on the set of the 2024 film It Ends With Us. The judge said Ms. Lively could still pursue other claims against Mr. Baldoni, including one that his production company retaliated against her after she had complained. A civil trial is scheduled for next month. A section of the West Coast Main Line between London Euston and Milton Keynes will be shut for 6 days from today. It's being upgraded as part of a £400 million project to improve reliability. Normal services will resume next Thursday.
Thanks very much indeed, Tom. 9 minutes past seven. Shoplifting is at its highest level since records began. Retailers have said it is spiralling out of control, with routine and brazen examples of thieves emptying shelves of high-value items, while in-store security officers are unable or unwilling to confront sometimes aggressive and violent offenders. A recent episode in Clapham in South London saw dozens of mainly younger people marauding through stores in scenes Sir Sadiq Khan, the Mayor of London, described as inexcusable and unacceptable. Marks and Spencer has taken the unusual step of writing to both the Mayor of London and the Home Secretary about their concerns. Adam Hawksby is External Affairs Director for Marks and Spencer and is on the line now. Good morning to you, Adam Hawksby. One of your colleagues has written a letter. Can you take us through exactly what your concerns are, what you've said?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're speaking out really on behalf of colleagues. You know, the people that work in our stores deserve to go to work each day without fear of intimidation or abuse or violence. And retail crime has always been a challenge, but it does feel in the past weeks and months that the problem is getting worse. We feel like we're doing our bit. We're investing tens of millions in security and across the retail sector. Retailers have invested $5.5 billion over the last 5 years. But there's only so much you can do with, you know, in-store security cards, body-worn cameras, and the tech that we have. So in our letter, we're calling on the Home Secretary and mayors across the country responsible for police forces to give police the resources and the tools that they need to tackle this problem. And to be really clear, police themselves, when they come into our store, when they work with us, are clearly doing all they can to solve this problem. But what we feel, what our colleagues feel, is that they don't necessarily have the backing that they need. And so that's why we decided to speak out.
So it's interesting. You say when the police do arrive, for example, in the Clapham incident, they worked quite effectively. So what I'm just trying to figure out exactly what it is that you want to more police on the beat, a panic button, an emergency. What exactly would you like to see?
Yeah, so it's really important to say that the Clapham incident this week has clearly sort of picked up on social media and generated coverage. But actually, you know, we were intending to write to the Home Secretary and the Mayor prior to these Clapham incidents. Okay. It's just one example of what we're seeing across the country. So in terms of those tools and resources for police, let me give you a really concrete example. In our store, our colleagues use an intelligence sharing platform. It's called Aura. It's basically a way that they can record when crimes are happening, spot repeat offenders, and share intelligence directly with the police. Now, where that works, it saves police time because you don't need two police officers in a car to come to a store and take a statement. And it also helps spot organized crime and criminal gangs. But we don't think that tool is being used consistently enough and tools like it consistently enough across forces. So just one of the concrete things we've asked for is for every force to be mandated to use tools like that so that when retailers are recording crimes, we know action's going to get taken.
I think it was a few years ago that there was a below £200 was considered deprioritised as a crime. Do you think that sent a signal? I mean, what do you put the inexorable rise you see, which came to a head in Clapham, down to?
Yeah, so look, we agree with the British Retail Consortium and others in calling for that £200 threshold to be scrapped. We want shoplifters who are in our stores to fear punishment regardless of the value of the products they're stealing. And again, that goes back to colleagues, right? So if you're a colleague in our store, whether you've got someone stealing a product worth £1 or hundreds of pounds worth of material, you still feel scared or intimidated or concerned. So we agree with that. In terms of the causes, I think what we're seeing in our stores is that we sometimes bear the brunt of wider societal challenges. And look, you know, we're not best placed to try and diagnose some of those root causes, but as I said, the Clapham incident was one. That was a group of young people. But we also see organized crime in our stores and crime gangs. We also see individuals that are under the influence of drugs and alcohol. So I think this is really complex. It's really systemic, which is why it's important that we have retailers and police forces and politicians all working side by side on this.
I should just say the Home Office have given us a statement from the Crime and Policing Minister, Sarah Jones, saying these disgraceful incidents are absolutely appalling. Mindless behaviour has no place in our society, and these criminals must face the full force of the law. We're giving police stronger powers, ending the immunity for thefts under £200 we were just discussing, so that shoplifters can be prosecuted. We urge the police to use all tools at their disposal to maintain order, protect workers and punish those responsible. What impact is it having on staff? Are people nervous about coming to work? And presumably it's not very good for business either.
Well, look, our colleagues are really resilient and they will always manage these incidents in the best way they can. But it clearly has an impact. And look, we've spoken out primarily because of the number of comments we've had from colleagues. Sometimes when they've seen reports in the media that, you know, retail crime numbers are going down, and they say it really doesn't feel like that to us. And for them, it means, you know, they're worried about coming into work. They might be nervous about the journey home. And that's not a position that we want our colleagues to be in. So really, it's with them at the forefront of our minds that we're engaging in this debate.
Do you think you've done everything you can? I mean, in terms of numbers of security personnel, for example, having some locks on, there was a story a couple of weeks ago, people beginning to put chocolate and other things behind cabinet, you know, so making shelves harder to pilfer from. Do you think you've done everything you can?
And look, there's always a balance, isn't there? You want stores to feel like welcoming places where you can browse goods without them being behind those sorts of guards or shelves or whatever else. But as you say, we need to be investing significant amounts to deter this problem. So we try and strike that balance. Other retailers do too. As I said, we've invested tens of millions. Are there things we could be doing with the Met Police and others to better share intelligence? I am sure. But really, our call today is, can we all get around the table and kind of roll our sleeves up and try and deal with this challenge? Because at the moment, it feels like it's going in the wrong direction.
Is it having a commercial impact? I'm just wondering. And they used to call it shrinkage, when people stuff would go missing from stores in shoplifting. What's actually happening to the bottom line?
Yeah, look, stock loss and shrink is a challenge for all retailers. And I think the British Retail Consortium will have some of the figures about the stock that is lost across the industry. For us, we're trying our very best to keep on top of this and to keep that stock loss to a low. But really, this was us ringing the alarm and saying, it feels like it's going in the direction. Can we get on top of it?
Okay. Listen, I must ask you about one other question, which is that your boss, Stuart Machin, wrote on LinkedIn recently saying that, complaining about energy costs and saying over the last few years, the policy costs on our energy bills have skyrocketed. These are tariffs that the government places on our bills to fund their policies, have nothing to do with the price of oil or gas. Obviously, these questions are being heightened in their profile by what's going on in the Middle East. What is it you're trying to get at there?
Well, I think we're of one with the government on this, and our food MD attended a meeting earlier this week.
Well, I don't think you are at one with... You're not at one with the government. You're criticising the government's policies.
So the thing that we agree on is that we want prices to be as low as possible for customers, and we want to make sure that the cost of the weekly shop does not rise over the next few months. And so I think what Stuart was drawing attention to there is, if you're considering what measures you could do to relieve pressures on retailers, one place you can look if your commodity costs of energy are rising, that cost of oil or gas, is those non-commodity costs and those policy costs. And as you say, they've risen significantly. I think they've tripled for us in the last 5 years. And so Stuart's intervention would say, if there are measures the government wants to take to relieve some of those pressures, then that would be a good place to start.
Is it your view that obviously what the government wants to do is read all retailers the Riot Act at the moment, whether petrol or whether grocery stores like yourself, and say that we can't have any profiteering. Do not use this Middle East crisis as a cover for sneaking through price increases. Do you think that your sector has received that message loud and clear?
We had a really constructive discussion with the Chancellor in the week, and we're continuing to have good discussions with the Treasury. All I'd say is, you know, the Competition and Markets Authority have repeatedly looked at the retail sector to ensure that it's competitive and there isn't that kind of activity going on. The most recent investigation was in 2024, which found a highly competitive sector. Food prices here significantly lower than in other parts of Europe. So we're having a really good discussion with the Treasury, and we're hoping to carry that on in the next few weeks as the situation develops.
Okay. Adam Hawksby, External Affairs Director for Marks and Spencers, and we'll be talking to the cost of living czar, Richard Walker, just in the next hour.
It's 18 minutes past seven. The US attack on Iran's largest and still under construction bridge has killed 8 people and injured nearly 100, according to the authorities there. It is another strike that blurs the lines between military and civilian infrastructure, with President Trump increasingly talking about focusing on the latter. Overnight, Dubai's government rejected as fake news claims by Iran's Revolutionary Guard that it had struck a data centre in the UAE. Let's speak to our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucet. Lise, good morning.
Good morning.
Important to remember, as you regularly point out to us and needs to be said, that the gap between what is talked about and what actually happens can be quite wide at times. But what is this telling us about the type of sites that are being struck and what the US in particular might do next?
Well, we heard from President Trump in his first primetime address during this conflict in the early hours of yesterday morning that he was, in his bombastic language, going to bomb Iran back to the Stone Ages, a comment that's been criticized both by legal experts warning about potential war crimes, also causing growing alarm among Iranians, even those who had dared to hope that the beginning of this war would mean the beginning of the end of the regime. He did say that if Iran didn't come to a deal, that they would hit every single one of their power plants, again, another potential war crimes. And then they've started hitting the bridges. And he has celebrated the hitting of this bridge, which linked Tehran with the nearby major city of Karaj. And in his latest post on Truth Social, he goes, bridges next, electric power plants, then electric power plants. And then he said he knows, Iran's leadership knows what it has to be done and done fast. And it's not just the bridges. Dr. Tedros, who heads the World Health Organization, which of course the US, President Trump had pulled out of the WHO, but he has regularly been expressing concern about the attacks on health facilities. The most recent is the century-old Pasteur Health Center. It's a major public health agency that had been producing and distributing vaccines, and Dr. Tedros reported that it had suffered significant damage. There was a report that Iran was using the center for other military-related activities, for other kinds of research, but it has been widely condemned as an unacceptable targeting in this war. You've been asking about what is Iran going to do in retaliation, because, of course, Israel has been expressing concern about where the missiles are landing there. Gulf states, of course, are furious about attacks on their infrastructure. And we did hear from the Speaker of the Iranian Parliament, Mohammed Bagher Ghalibaf, who regularly hits back against President Trump on social media. He used that biblical expression, eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth in this war. So the language is escalating. And in a war where President Trump has again said his deadlines are always fluid, that there would be another 2 to 3 weeks, this targeting on both sides, on all sides, raises questions about what is going to be hit next.
Thank you, Lise. Lise Doucet there, our chief international correspondent.
21 minutes past seven. Let's get some more business news. And the price and availability of jet fuel is uppermost in many airlines' mind. Fliss.
Yes, absolutely. And that's because the last shipment of jet fuel from the Middle East is expected to arrive in the UK later today. And we've seen some regional airlines beginning to cancel routes to deal with soaring prices. Remember, the Middle East supplies more than half of the UK's jet fuel, and prices have nearly doubled since the US-Israel war with Iran began. Ryanair's chief executive, Michael O'Leary, has been reported saying the airline might now cancel between 5 and 10% of early summer flights. The regional carrier Skybus cancelled its service between London and Cornwall as a result of the rising cost of fuel. Let's talk to Nico Bezuidenhout, chief executive of Orini Air Services. That's Guernsey's regional airline, which flies to destinations across the UK. Nico, good morning. You have cut back on some of your routes recently. What and why?
Good morning, Felicity. As you mentioned, oil pricing and jet fuel pricing has had a material effect on cost structures. So we took the proactive step of reducing approximately 12% of our flight capacity between April and May this year, not due to concerns in terms of jet fuel supply, but rather to ensure that we get higher levels of load factors, and in that way try and reduce the impact of soaring jet prices on consumers.
So more people in seats brings down the overall price. I mean, can you give me an example then? How much more is a single flight costing you compared to a month ago?
Well, depending on what aircraft type you operate, if you are narrow-bodied aircraft, ranges from about $600 to $2,100 per flight hour in extra cost. Our jet pricing has gone up approximately 120% since the start of the Iran crisis.
So pretty significant. You're taking steps to try and keep those prices down by streamlining the flights you are putting on. Are you having to pass some costs on to your passengers?
Yes. In the end, we take three types of measures to try and mitigate the impact. The one is about watching where we fly, being more efficient, more effective, filling our seats more effectively, as I've mentioned before. The second approach is fuel hedging. Approximately 20 to 50% of our fuel volumes are hedged out at fixed pricing, and that mitigates some of the effect. And then there's a residual impact on the consumer, and that gets passed through in the form of either fares or fuel levies or the like. In our case, we've had to institute a temporary measure of £2 per passenger for the next 2 to 3 months, depending on how long this crisis lasts.
Airlines UK says UK airlines are currently not seeing disruption to jet fuel supply and continue to engage with fuel suppliers and the government to monitor the situation. In a word, are you expecting shortages?
Not in the short term. For the next 4 to 6 weeks, there's supply certainty both on the Guernsey side as well as on the UK side. We've had assurances from multiple suppliers and airports, and we'll have to continue to monitor it.
Nico Bezuidenhout, Chief Executive of Aurini Air Services, thank you very much.
Thank you, Fliss.
Now, the largest ever investment in species protection will be announced later today. £90 million from the Department of the Environment will help safeguard hundreds of species. Dr. Tony Juniper, Chair of Natural England, joins us. And be spent on what?
Well, a combination of different activities, including habitat improvement, captive breeding, translocation of animals and plants from different places to reinforce populations, and a lot of research to understand what are going to be the most effective interventions that we can back to bring species from either the brink of extinction, in some cases even beyond it in terms of national extinction, to start restoring the fabric of the country's natural environment. And we know that this works because we've been at this for decades at Natural England, helping many rare species back from beyond the brink in some cases. So the return of the beaver has attracted a lot of attention lately. Those animals have been absent in England for about 700 years. The pool frog, an amphibian of eastern England, went extinct in the 1990s, now back. The lady slipper orchid went down to a single plant. They're now reproducing again in the wild. So we know that this investment can work. And at Natural England, we're absolutely delighted that government has chosen to take this step.
Right. What are the forces that this money is combating in a way? Is it housing? Is it pollution? Is it farming? What are the forces that you're up against?
Well, the combination of factors affecting different species varies across all of the different animals and plants that we're looking at. However, there are some big cross-cutting themes that I think most of your listeners will be familiar with. One is pollution, the build-up of different substances in the environment that change conditions, causing animals and plants to decline. So rivers with excess nutrients, the effect of pesticides, historically the effects of acid rain, for example. Another big one is habitat loss. So in this country for millennia, we have been changing the landscape to meet human needs. We don't have to see a choice, however, between agriculture, infrastructure, housing and nature recovery. We can do both. And this money will help us understand exactly the interventions that will enable that. And then the other thing is just
so I'm clear, you're not concerned then, for example, that a greater emphasis on planning and building new houses and an assumption of approval for those planning things are basically making what you're doing harder.
No, it's a question of how we do it. I'm speaking to you from a suburban garden in the middle of a city, and there's a lot of bird song here. If I went out to some of the very intensive agriculture outside the city, there might be less bird song in some of the places I could stand. So it's not a case of whether there's an either or here. Is it nature or is it infrastructure and housing? We can do both if we take intelligent approaches, and doing that from the beginning of a project design, whether it's a road or a railway or a new town, if we build nature in at the beginning, we can do both. Can and we know that from experience.
Just a very quick question. When the red kite obviously was something that almost died out, and then there's loads of them now. How did you do that? Did you just bring in a breeding pair from somewhere and off they go?
Well, this is exactly, this is actually probably the best example of historical efforts on this subject, because many of your listeners will have seen one. So the red kite, down to a tiny remnant population in mid Wales, extinct in England for a very long time. That bird came back as a result of, again, very careful scientific research to understand its needs.
Okay.
And then bringing birds back from Spain, from Sweden, some from East Germany, careful releases, soft releases from cages where the birds could see the environment they were going to be moving into, and they took very quickly and are now spread across the entire country. A fantastic success story.
They certainly are. Dr. Tony Juniper, Chair of Natural England, thank you.
Let's get the sport with Jonathan.
Morning. Again, my weather app says it's 8 degrees outside, but it feels like 4. There's rain forecast for much of the country, so that must mean one thing. It's the start of the new county cricket season. A 2-pullover day at least for all players involved on this opening day, including the team which finished 2025 on such a high.
Final ball of the over. Notts 296 for 6. Perena will pull this one away. All the way for a huge 6. And Perena has done it. And Nottinghamshire are county champions for the first time in 15 years.
A great moment for Nottinghamshire and their South African wicketkeeper, Kyle Perena. And after featuring Division 1 newcomers Leicestershire on yesterday's programme, we can talk to the champions. The Notts Director of Cricket, Mick Newell, who's in Taunton for their opening match against Somerset, is on the line. Good morning.
Good morning, Jonathan.
How challenging to repeat... Well, nice to talk to you. And how challenging to repeat that success like Surrey did before you 3 times in a row?
Yeah, very challenging. I think what Surrey did is a fantastic achievement. And I think we knew last season that if we could come ahead of Surrey, we were probably going to be top of the league because they're that strong and they've been strong for a number of years now. So challenge begins today at Somerset, at Taunton, against a very good team down here as well.
How helpful that Ben Duckett, your England opener, has chosen the Championship County Cricket over IPL?
It will be very helpful. I mean, he's not playing down here, but he's going to play starting next week, Trent Bridge against Glamorgan. And I think it's just a sign of the importance to somebody like Ben of Test Match cricket, in that he sacrificed quite a big and lucrative contract in the IPL to make sure that when England start playing against New Zealand in June, he wants to be in the best possible form.
After the Ashes defeat in the winter, the English leadership said they wanted a stronger relationship with the counties. And Brendan McCallum and the director of cricket, Rob Key, had a call with all coaches and directors of cricket on Wednesday. What did you learn? Because you were part of that call.
Yes, they did. I mean, it was reinforcing a lot of their selection priorities, really, and making sure that we understand the types of player that they think will be successful in international cricket, so that we can identify those perhaps in our squad, make sure that they're encouraged to know that the door is now probably back more open than it's been for a couple of years anyway. And there are going to be more opportunities this summer, because I don't think that team is as set in stone as it has been.
What do you hope that relationship looks like in practice, though, for the whole season? One call's great and lots of intentions, but actually, for 6 months, how's it going to look?
I think more visibility from the England setup. I think, you know, they brought in a new bowling coach called Troy Cooley, who was last here about 15 years ago. I think we'll see him around the counties, coming out to watch, coming out to talk to coaches. So I think a visibility of people, not necessarily Brendan. He's got a full-time role. We completely understand that. But Rob Key, the new national selector, when they're in place, and Troy Cooley and the other coaches need to be visible around the county game so that they are seen to be watching players and identifying talent for the future.
And in terms of the replacement players are going to be allowed in county cricket this season for the first time. They're going to cover illness and significant life events as well as injuries. Is that a welcome move?
I think it is. I think it has to be. I mean, cricket's been quite slow in terms of, you know, a player gets injured and all you can do is have a sub fielder so far. That fielder can't bat or bowl, so you're effectively playing with 10. So I think it's a welcome move. It's been trialled around the world, in Australia, South Africa in particular, this winter. And I think it'll be fascinating to see. I'm sure some point over this weekend, the first replacement player will come in and join a game halfway through and be able to bat and bowl and take a full part.
Final question. How's the weather in Taunton? Are you cold? Are you warm?
I'm staying inside the hotel till about 10:30. But the players have to leave shortly.
Very good. Mick Newell, thank you very much indeed. Every ball of every county match live on the BBC website and BBC Sounds. It all starts today.
Jonathan, thank you. Let's have a quick look ahead to the other end of the day here on Radio 4.
Screenshot is where we journey through the multiverse of the moving image.
I'm Eleni Jones.
And I'm Mark Kermode. Every week we agree on a subject to begin with and then go off on our own, sometimes very different directions.
Along the way, we're joined by a top-notch array of guests and experts to make sense of it all.
In the new series, we trace the evolution of teachers on screen.
Crofton Cinema has this shared experience. There's something that happens in the classroom that will also happen while watching a film.
We mark the 25th anniversary of Amélie's Paris, and as Mel Brooks turns 100, ask what spoofs still mean today.
The new series of Screenshot.
On Radio 4 and BBC Sound, starting tonight at 7:15.
Let's take a look at the weather. Jonathan was talking about the temperature. It is going to be dry and sunny for many of us initially, but it will turn cloudier into tonight with rain developing before Storm Dave heads in over the weekend.
You can tell which meteorologists have chosen this storm's name. There's definitely the Brits have that. Storm Dave. Yes, and on the programme a little later, we'll be hearing from Reform UK's Robert Jenrick on his party's plans to keep the triple lock on pensions. That's just in a few moments.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Simon Jack in London, Anna Foster in Salford, and Tom Sanders has a summary of the news.
Executives at Marks & Spencer have called for the government and the Mayor of London to do more to combat high street crime. They say shoplifting and attacks on staff are becoming more brazen, more organised and more aggressive. The Home Office said it was giving police stronger powers. A spokesperson for the Mayor, Sir Sadiq Khan, said he would continue working with officers to tackle the issue. NASA's Artemis 2 mission has left the Earth's orbit and is heading for the moon. The crew fired the engine of their spacecraft and sent it on the next stage of its voyage. The four astronauts are due to travel further from the Earth than anyone has been before. They said the views of their home planet were spectacular. A new National Democracy Protection Unit will support police forces in tackling the rising level of threats and abuse faced by MPs. A senior officer has been appointed to coordinate intelligence and help with investigations. MPs say threats against their lives have become more commonplace and many aren't reported to police. President Trump has said that the US will continue to step up its attacks on Iran's infrastructure if Iranian leaders don't agree his terms to end the war. State media say 8 people were killed and nearly 100 injured when a bridge near Tehran was bombed. The US Attorney General Pam Bondi has been sacked by President Trump. She's been criticised for her handling of the release of the files relating to the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The position will be temporarily filled by Mr. Trump's former personal lawyer, Todd Blanche. A teaching union has warned that more staff will leave the profession unless there are changes to make it easier to combine the job with being a parent. The NASUWT is calling for 26 weeks of fully paid maternity leave for teachers across the UK, as well as flexible working rights. The government recently proposed doubling the amount of time teachers and school leaders in England receive full pay on maternity leave from 4 weeks to 8.
Thank you, Tom. It's just after 25 to 8. Now, with just over a month to go now to local elections and voting in Scotland and Wales, the cost of living is preoccupying all of the main parties as they try to garner votes. Today, Reform UK is talking about its measures, including scrapping air passenger duty and maintaining the triple lock on pensions. That is, the commitment to increase the state pension each April by whichever is the highest of three measures, earnings, inflation or 2.5%. It had considered ending that. Nigel Farage, you might remember, said last year that he shared the concern that pensions were unaffordable on a national level. Well, Robert Jenrick joins us, the Reform UK Treasury spokesperson. Good morning.
Good morning.
We'll get on to the triple lock in just a second. I wanted to talk about air passenger duty first, because flights are generally quite cheap. And with the cost of living crisis, people are looking at heating bills. They're looking at what it costs to fill their cars. Is that really the direction that they're looking for relief on at the moment, flights?
Well, actually, Reform has put forward easily the most comprehensive plan to tackle the cost of living of any of the parties, and in fact, other political parties are following our lead. We've said that we would scrap VAT on domestic fuel. We've said we'd get rid of the green levies and taxes that are loaded onto people's home energy bills, which together would save £200 off the average energy bill. We said that we should obviously not proceed with the fuel duty rise that's coming down the line in September, and as an emergency measure, like many other countries are doing at the moment, have a short-term cut, in fact, a halving of VAT when you're filling up at the pumps. So those are the main measures that we've proposed, which would have a significant and immediate impact on people's cost of living. But we've also said, yes, we do want people to be able to aspire to go on a family holiday. And for many people, the cost of air passenger duty on a family holiday is significant. If you were getting a flight as a family to Malaga, for example, it would be a 23% reduction in the cost of those family flights if you got rid of the air passenger duty on the adult costs of the tickets. And this would also apply to grandparents, school trips and so on. And so I think it will be a small, I admit, but helpful measure for people who want to just get away, enjoy a break this summer.
Your former Conservative colleagues say that you got your maths wrong in this, that you say that the passenger duty change costs £142 million a year, but your five-year figure in the press material is £566 million, when, of course, five times 142 is £710 million. What's gone wrong there?
No, I saw that slightly bizarre tweet from someone who obviously hadn't understood the situation. In fact, what we'd said, and those who asked, we explained it to, we said that this would be implemented over the course of 1 year, and so the numbers wouldn't start to kick in until the second year of the Parliament, as is normal with these measures, because you'd obviously have to legislate for it, and it would come into play in the next financial year. And then the £142 million is the average of the cost over the 4 years thereafter, and so the numbers completely add up.
But they're saying that 142 times five, and even if you're saying it's staggered year by year, they're still saying that the total cost over 5 years is not correct.
No, because the measure actually comes into place in the next financial year after the next general election. And so there wouldn't be a cost in the first year of the Parliament, because you've also got to do a budget, you've got to legislate for the measure because this is air passenger duty, and then it would come into play in April of the year after the general election. So there'd be 4 years in which this would be in place, and £142 million is the average number in those 4 years. Some years are slightly more, some years are slightly less. So it's actually been very detailed in the way in which it's been modelled, and we've done that in concert with airlines and with their trade bodies, who've all incidentally come out and strongly welcomed this.
OK, let's turn to the triple lock, because Reform UK, you weren't entirely sure as a party what you wanted to do about this, whether you wanted to scrap it, whether you wanted to keep it. You've now come down on the side of keeping it. It is a very, very expensive measure, but it's one that's popular with older voters. What was behind that choice?
We chose to prioritise pensioners. You're absolutely right, because we don't want to see people in the last decades of their lives having to choose between heating their home or putting food on the table. And at a moment like this, when the cost of living is so difficult for everyone, it's those people who are on fixed incomes, who can't just earn some more, take on more hours at work, who we really should be thinking about and have uppermost in our thoughts.
Okay.
We understand how expensive this is, and that is why we took time to come to this conclusion. We looked at the forecast on how much this might cost, even in the worst case scenarios, and we thought about how we would pay for it. And
yes,
we set that out.
That's the question, because you haven't set that out yet, have you? How you'll pay for it?
We have. We've already found savings which are more than enough to cover even the worst case scenarios. We've set out £40 billion of cuts to public spending in areas which the other parties, certainly the government, would never do, like ending net zero subsidies, stopping giving foreign aid to rich countries, not paying universal credit to people who aren't British citizens, and really tackling the welfare budget more generally. And we've said, in addition to those measures, that we're going to be setting out in some detail in the coming weeks, very shortly, in fact, a very, very significant package of welfare reforms focused on the individuals
sort of
who came into the country during the period
yet.
Of the Boris wave. Well, they are.
You're saying that the details...
In the sense that we're going even further than we need to do. We've already set out
details
that are commensurate
very
with the saving.
Shortly. They are commensurate with the saving, because this is a huge amount of money that you're talking about here. And people will wonder why.
I wouldn't be making this promise unless we were certain that we could fund it. And what I'm saying to you this morning is we've already set out savings of £40 billion a year, which are enough, even in the worst-case scenarios. And, of course, it's difficult to predict with certainty the true cost of the triple lock in the years ahead, because it's reliant on forecasts for inflation and earnings. But we've taken pessimistic forecasts And the £40 billion of savings that we've set out is more than enough to cover that. But we will be going further than that, is the point that I'm making,
okay,
in the next
when
few
will
weeks.
We see those?
And in particular, looking at the welfare budget.
Will that be before the elections?
Yes.
OK, so people will have numbers on which to base their vote on.
Yeah, we'll be setting out, we'll be particularly focusing on the economic cost, the fiscal cost of those individuals who came into the country during the Boris
yeah.
wave.
I was just,
these are the millions of people who came
really.
Into the country.
Because as people are deciding, as they are now, because it's only a few weeks away, people are deciding how to vote. So you're saying they'll get those numbers before they go to the polls.
Yes, absolutely. But I want to underline the point that the commitment that we've made with respect to the triple lock, we've already set out the cuts to public spending in the areas I've just described. And those are commensurate with the cost of this, even in the most difficult circumstances.
It's a compelling argument, as you said, for older voters. It's a very compelling argument for them. But what about younger voters who can't get on the housing ladder, who are struggling with things like tuition fees, who can't get a job, who are struggling with apprenticeships, who look at that older generation, as many of them do, and say, hang on, they've had it really good compared to me. What do you say to those people who also will have a vote in a few weeks' time?
Well, I'd say two things. Firstly, it's never been the case that young people don't care what happens to their parents and their grandparents. And, you know, we all know that talking to our own children, our friends and neighbours, and all of the evidence, the polling and so on, says so as well. People want older people to be able to live out their lives in dignity and security. But you're right to say that the younger generation in this country have been treated appallingly in recent decades. Wages have stagnated, the ability to get on the housing ladder has diminished, and the social contract in many respects in this country has been shredded. What we want to do at Reform is to take that on. No, absolutely not. Because we want to get good jobs back into the country by making the country competitive again. That's how we become a rich country once more. And we do that with a different energy policy, by ending the net zero madness that's destroying good jobs, by removing regulation, which is making it so difficult for people to be small business people and to set up successful businesses in the country, and by tackling bills. And that's what we set out with the cost of living measures we discussed at the beginning of the interview, which of course is going to affect everyone.
Right. Time is against us, but thank you, Robert Jenrick, the Reform UK Treasury spokesperson.
It is almost exactly 8:15.
Lots to squeeze in between now and 8 o'clock. Let us look at what is happening high above us in the skies. Artemis 2 had a really successful moment overnight. It fired its thrusters, the Orion capsule, for the next leg of the journey, which will send the craft and the four astronauts towards the moon. Have a listen. This is the voice of the capsule command communicator, CAPCOM, as it's called, part of NASA's Mission Control Center in Houston, giving the astronauts permission for a translunar injection burn start. That is the key thing that happened successfully, flawlessly, as NASA called it, overnight.
10 seconds until translunar injection burn start.
Integrity, good engine, good control.
We have the start of the translunar injection burn that will send the crew around the moon, the first humans to do so in over 50 years. Velocity of the spacecraft ticking up, now over 23,900 miles per hour.
Integrity looks like a good burn. We're confirming.
Orion, now 520 miles away from Earth. Just 5 minutes ago, we were only 115 miles above Earth's surface. That distance will continue to increase as we are now on a trajectory to fly around the moon for the first time in over 50 years.
Let's talk to Dame Dr. Maggie Adarin, space scientist, science communicator. You forget, don't you? You listen to that and you forget that every one of these little moments is so complex and so vital and means so much.
Yeah, but each one of them does. And I think that's why they do these missions in the way they're doing them. So this mission isn't actually landing on the moon, but it's heading out towards the moon now. And so, yes, because each one is so complicated, they want to test it, make sure everything's working. And so eventually the goal is to get boots on the moon, probably about 2028.
And all of those calculations. I was rewatching Hidden Figures last night. I think it was on Film 4 or something. They're obviously tapping into everybody's, you know, newfound excitement for space. And it sort of, it reminds you about how difficult these things are. I know we've been to the moon before, but it's an enormously complex and challenging thing to pull off successfully.
It is. And it's all about the orbital dynamics. So you heard a translunar injection burn. So that is effectively putting your foot on the gas and getting the engine sort of revved up and you're firing off to the moon. But that is the last burn they're going to do. Because of the orbital dynamics, what they're going to do is they're going to head towards the moon. Then the gravity of the moon will swing them round and then they will actually fall back to Earth, pulled back to Earth by the gravity. So no more burns on that trip. And also the dynamics of getting it out towards the moon. They've been in orbit around the Earth for just over 24 hours. And as they fall towards the Earth, they pick up speed. They put the foot on the gas and whoosh, they're off to the moon. So it's a wonderful dance of orbital dynamics.
It is. And a really heartening moment for you as well, because we've spoken so many times over the years and your enthusiasm, you're always talking about space, whether there's a moon mission or not. And you sort of look back at, there was a time when going to the moon just got a bit boring for people, and that's why we started doing it. But people are so enthusiastic about this now.
It is. And you're exactly right. When they were doing the moon landings, the Apollo missions, they had more planned, but people just lost interest. But what I'm very excited about personally is that we're going back to the moon now, but with purpose. Last time it was lots of saber rattling. They were trying to beat the USSR. But this time we're going back to the moon and we're actually intending to sort of make a lunar base. Since the interim of the past 50 years, it sounds as if it's been quiet, but we've been doing lots of research on the moon. The sort of things I make, sort of satellites that go in orbit about other bodies, we've been making them, and we've discovered that there is actually frozen water at the south pole of the moon. We're not too sure how much, but the intention is to actually sort of go to that south pole and potentially make a lunar base and use that as a foothold to travel out into the rest of the solar system. So exciting times ahead.
All of these things, aren't there? We're waiting to find out. Thank you, Dame Dr. Maggie Adderin. Worth saying as well, just before nine, we're going to talk about exactly that for scientific purposes, but also the monetization of the moon as well, which will surely come before too long.
Dame Maggie's enthusiasm is enough to get anyone, infectiousness, get anyone excited. I've got some people close to me who are like, meh, wake me up when we get to Mars.
Oh no, you need to school them, Simon. You do. You really do.
Anyway, in a few minutes, we'll hear from the man who's tasked with tackling the rising cost of living, Iceland boss Richard Walker. But first, it's time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning in the studio is the Reverend Lucy Winkett, Rector of St James Piccadilly. Good morning.
Good morning. The sculptor, Cornelia Parker, placed dynamite in a garden shed and blew it up. She then collected the fragments and suspended them from the ceiling, freezing in time the moment the explosion happened. All the jagged parts of wooden walls and roof, the contents, the domestic debris of a life collected in a garden shed, exploded and held in suspension around a single bare light bulb at the centre of the fragments hanging in the air. As with all visual art, there have been a variety of interpretations. A vision of the cosmos, say some, reminiscent of a galaxy far away. A comment on modern fragmented society, say others. For me, it's a powerful picture of grief. The garden shed was full of objects that illustrate and accompany a life. Magazines, a chair to relax in, a radio tuned to a favourite station. The explosion was real and destructive. All the fragments of building and contents were gathered and then reassembled, not now a solid, earthbound shed, but a semblance of a shed. A shattered building, held in suspension before the pieces fall. Today is Good Friday, the day Jesus is executed, an explosion of grief as the cry from the cross echoes across the earth, my God, why have you forsaken me? When we grieve, our lives can feel as if they've exploded. The violence of our reaction can surprise and scare us. The pieces of our life are strangely familiar still, but they're all in the wrong place. The fragments of our life cut our hands when we try to get things together again. And that's why the intellectual considerations of Christian doctrine are, to my mind, for another day. They don't cut it for me in the light of the turbulent and explosive grief being caused on a huge scale in our hubristic, self-regarding and bellicose world. When I dare to stay at the foot of Christ's cross today, witness to the attempted destruction of love itself, a light is shone on the ways that I, along with you, despite our best intentions, often act violently out of fear, or from a misplaced anxiety that if I don't win, then somehow I won't live. At the foot of the cross, I'm faced today with all the truths about myself that I habitually avoid. I am addressed by this gentle and patient love that holds the stars apart, that offers humanity the possibility that we can learn to live another way. Love crucified that surely and irrevocably will pour contempt on all my pride.
That was Thought for the Day with the Reverend Lucy Winkett, the rector of St James's Piccadilly. It is 7 minutes to eight.
The cost of living crisis is back. In truth, of course, for many, it never went away. The rate of inflation may have come down from the eye-watering levels of over 10% we saw after the energy crisis of 2022. But prices never came down. They just went up more slowly, leaving permanent scars in people's living standards. And the current crisis in the Middle East will inevitably start pushing inflation back up again. Little wonder that the government has made the cost of living one of its primary themes. Petrol retailers, supermarket bosses have been hauled in and read the Riot Act about potential profiteering by using the crisis as an excuse to push up prices and, in their words, rip off customers. So is that actually happening? And if it is, what can be done to stop it? Richard Walker, Lord Richard Walker, is the government's cost of living champion. He's also the executive chair of Iceland Foods and a Labour peer and joins us. Good morning, Lord Walker. What exactly is your job in a situation like this?
Well, I was brought into this role to bring some fresh ideas, outside thinking, challenge and a bit of urgency as well. I think any household in the UK wouldn't forgive a champion, as my role's called, who doesn't try and protect their interests, which is what I'm trying to do.
Well, as a retailer yourself, you must know the tricks of the trade. You know, what are they and have you seen any evidence of that in retail, for example?
Of profiteering?
Yes.
But we're in an interesting position now, aren't we? Because there's quite a lot of narrative, as you've just been alluding to, about costs going up and the pressure on energy for companies and potential supply issues. So I think it's really important now to focus in and look at the food sector, for example, and make sure that large businesses, I have more sympathy with small businesses, but large businesses are focused on risk mitigation. Now, for us at Iceland, we had a big and painful lesson with energy in the Ukraine war. So our costs now are locked in. Our energy bills are secured through to next year. And we're also working closely with our supply chain to adopt models given the past few years. Unfortunately, nothing in terms of food comes through the Strait of Hormuz. So at the moment, we're in a good place, and I think the sector is in a good place. But of course, I'm not tone deaf to the issue that there are pressures increasingly so as the war goes on.
So you're the consumer, you're the cost of living champion, and you're in the retail business. You say there's no profiteering. So hauling all these bosses in, is that just performative by the government?
No, I mean, look, the main, you know, what can the government do? I think they should provide targeted support to households, but actually what they can also do is listen to and work with business to try and come up with solutions.
Like what, though? I hear this, but I'm just trying to get specific.
I suppose it's a shot across the bows. I mean, I was talking a few weeks ago about putting petrol retailers and petrochemicals, etc., on notice that they shouldn't be profiteering. And I think it's quite important that the government should use the powers that it has to put on notice companies that they shouldn't use this crisis for profiteering. Yeah. And that's where the CMA, Ofgem, etc., come in, and where they have stepped in the past in 22, 23.
Lord Wolfson, the boss of Next, suggested that it's not the government might be doing a bit of profiteering itself. For example, it's getting a lot more money in things like fuel duty than it would otherwise have done, and therefore, would you be advising the government to, you know, not just which plans to raise fuel duty in phased in from September, but to actually cut it now?
In terms of the trying to balance the books of the government, I think we're all aware of the sticky situation that we found ourselves in. The 5p fuel duty cut that you allude to is an interesting one. That's going to expire in September. I think given where we are, we do need to be thinking and talking about extending it or enlarging it. Interestingly, the Australian government, I was reading, have recently taken a 14p per litre cut to their fuel tax. I mean, this cut is 5p. So Lord Wolfson is a great guy and very intelligent, and he might have a point there.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. Richard Walker, Lord Walker, government's cost of living champion and executive chair of Ice and Foods. Thank you.
Here is James Cook with details of this evening's Any Questions.
Tonight we are in Croydon in South London with a panel of politicians to discuss the week's news both here and abroad. We have two former cabinet ministers with us, Lord Charlie Faulkner for Labour and Dame Penny Mordaunt for the Conservatives. They'll be joined by the Liberal Democrats' Shadow Attorney General Ben Maguire and Plaid Cymru's finance spokesperson Helleth Vaughan. There are a small number of tickets left, so if you would like to spend your Good Friday with us, go to the Any Questions website for details. Otherwise, we're live on Radio 4 tonight at 8pm or any time after that on BBC Sounds.
Thank you, James. Let's get some weather with Ben Rich. Ben.
Thank you, Simon. Morning to you. Quite a cloudy Good Friday ahead. Certainly at first, rather grey and murky out there right now. Damp and drizzly too. Some mist and murk around western coasts and hills. As we go through the day across the southwest of England and the southeast of England, it's going to stay mostly cloudy with the odd spot of rain or drizzle at times. For Wales, the Midlands and eastern England, after a cloudy and damp morning, things should brighten up a little into the afternoon with sunny spells and a few showers. Now, for all of Northern England and for Northern Ireland, we will see some outbreaks of rain. Could be the odd heavy burst for a time through the morning into the early afternoon. But then things will turn brighter with some sunny spells and one or two showers later on. And for Scotland, clouds should break up quite quickly this morning to give sunny spells and showers. Some of the showers will be wintry over high ground in the northwest of Scotland. A breezy day, temperatures north to south around 8 to 16 degrees. Tonight's clear spells, a touch of frost in the north. For Saturday night, we will see some very wet and windy weather in the north of the UK thanks to Storm Dave.
Yeah, looking forward to that or not. Thank you, Ben. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Simon Jack and Anna Foster.
It's 8 o'clock on Friday the 3rd of April. The headlines this morning: Marks and Spencer say retail crime is getting worse and it's accused the government and the Mayor of London of not doing enough to tackle it. The astronauts on NASA's Artemis 2 mission have fired their spacecraft's engine to escape Earth's orbit and set them on their way to the moon. And the general who led the military coup in Myanmar that overthrew Aung San Suu Kyi has been appointed president.
Also coming up in the next hour of the programme, should the government allow more drilling for oil and gas to take place in the North Sea? A former chief executive of BP, Lord Brown, thinks so.
In order to have a proper approach to energy right now, we need all sources available to us.
And as the Artemis mission takes another giant leap forward, we'll hear from astronaut Major Tim Peake and ask whether we really can mine the moon. The BBC News is read by Tom Sanders.
Senior executives at Marks and Spencer have called on the Home Secretary and the Mayor of London to do more to tackle high street crime. An M&S store was among those targeted by teenagers during disturbances over the past few days in Clapham in London. Writing in the Daily Telegraph today, the firm's retail director warns of growing lawlessness, saying shoplifting and attacks on staff are becoming more brazen, more organised and more aggressive. Here's our political correspondent, Katie Austin.
This is an unusual and strongly worded intervention from Marks & Spencer's retail director, Tinas Keeve. He says he keeps hearing crime is falling, but retail workers are seeing the opposite. Staff are on the receiving end of abuse and violence on a daily basis, and while the problem is worse in London, it is happening across the country. Mr. Keeve says retailers are powerless without a government seriously cracking down on crime and a mayor who prioritises effective policing. He calls for a stronger, faster and more consistent police response. Adam Hawkesby is Marks & Spencer's head of external affairs.
We've spoken out primarily because of the number of comments we've had from colleagues. Sometimes when they've seen reports in the media that retail crime numbers are going down, and they say it really doesn't feel like that to us. And for them, it means, you know, they're worried about coming into work. They might be nervous about the journey home. And that's not a position that we want our colleagues to be in. So really, it's with them at the forefront of our minds that we're engaging in this debate.
A spokesperson for the Mayor of London, Sir Sadiq Khan, said he would continue working with the Met Police to tackle the issue. The Home Office said it was giving police stronger powers.
NASA's Artemis 2 mission has left Earth's orbit on the first crewed journey to the moon for more than 50 years. Overnight, the four astronauts on board the Orion spacecraft fired its engine to free the capsule from Earth's gravitational pull. Our science correspondent Pallab Ghosh sent this report from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida.
We have the start of the translunar injection burn that will send the crew around the moon, the first humans to do so in over 50 years.
This was a key moment in the astronauts' historic voyage. The TLI burn has given the spacecraft the big push it needs to leave the Earth's orbit.
Velocity of the spacecraft ticking up, now over 23,900 miles per hour.
As Orion surges into deep space, the astronauts will see, through its windows, the Earth shrinking into a small blue and white marble, while the moon grows from a bright disk into a heavily cratered world. On about the sixth day of the mission, as the spacecraft cruises beyond the moon, the crew are expected to witness a total solar eclipse from deep space. The moon will completely cover the sun's bright face to reveal its normally concealed shimmering halo, with the Earth seen to one side. No wonder Jeremy Hansen, the Canadian astronaut on board Orion, said minutes after the TLI burn,
"Crew's feeling pretty good up here on our way to the moon. Humanity has once again shown what we are capable of."
President Trump has said there is much more to follow after the US bombed Iran's largest bridge. Iranian state media says eight people were killed. Iran launched fresh strikes at targets in Israel and the Gulf states overnight, including an oil refinery in Kuwait. With the latest on the conflict, here's our Middle East correspondent, Yolande Nell.
The US and Israel have stepped up their attacks on Iran's infrastructure. Iranian state media say many people were picnicking near the B-1 suspension bridge for the end of the Persian New Year holidays when it was hit by US warplanes. In a post on his Truth Social platform, President Trump wrote, "much more to follow," and later suggested electric power plants could be next. Iran has continued to show its ability to strike its neighbors overnight. A drone attack on Kuwait's national oil company is said to have caused several fires. An Iranian missile with a cluster warhead was fired at central Israel, damaging property at a number of sites, but with no reports of injuries.
Police forces are being offered specialist support from a new National Democracy Protection Unit to deal with the rising level of threats and abuse faced by MPs. The number of alleged offences against parliamentarians has increased every year since 2019, reaching almost 1,000 last year. The new unit will coordinate intelligence on threats to politicians and assist officers investigating alleged offenders. The Labour MP Kim Leadbeater is the sister of Jo Cox, the MP who was killed in her constituency in 2016. She told us she felt really sad that such a unit was needed.
No MP I know, no councillor I know wants to be wrapped in cotton wool. But we have to do something, because if not, what will happen? We will lose good people from public life because they don't feel safe. And we will stop good people wanting to enter public life because of the risks involved with that. And that does have a deep impact on our democracy.
Donald Trump has fired his Attorney General, Pam Bondi, hours after releasing a statement saying she was doing a great job. He said that she was moving to a new role in the private sector. Ms. Bondi has faced criticism for her handling of the release of files relating to the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. From Washington, Ione Wells.
You might think, reading Donald Trump and Pam Bondi's statements on her firing, that nothing had been wrong. Mr. Trump said she was a loyal friend and a patriot. She said she was thrilled to be moving to a new role. But behind the scenes, there had been growing frustration at her handling of the Epstein files, which had become a political liability for the Trump administration. There were also concerns about her performance and communication style when appearing at congressional hearings.
I'm going to answer the question.
Answer my question.
No, I'm going to answer the question the way I want to answer the question.
No, you're going to answer the
question. Donald Trump has tried to take control of the Department of Justice, even putting a picture of his face on the building here in Washington. He has called for investigations and prosecutions of several of his political foes, but he's been frustrated at the progress of some of these investigations.
The man who led the military coup in Myanmar that overthrew Aung San Suu Kyi 5 years ago has been chosen by Parliament as the country's new president. General Minh Aung Hlaing has stepped down as head of the military, but the new government will still be dominated by the armed forces. More details from our Southeast Asia correspondent, Jonathan Head.
Myanmar now has a president and an elected parliament, but this is civilian rule in name only. Min Aung Hlaing has long coveted the top job. Now that he's got it, he's giving no indication that he might soften the brutal campaign he's waged against the armed opposition. His appointment of a hardline loyalist to succeed him as military commander means that the relentless use of air and drone strikes against insurgent-held towns and villages is likely to continue. Millions of people have already been displaced from their homes, and the economy is in ruins, compounded now by the acute fuel shortages caused by the war in Iran.
A teaching union has warned that more teachers will leave the profession unless there are changes to make the job easier to combine with being a parent. The NASUWT is calling for 26 weeks of fully paid maternity leave, as well as greater rights to flexible working. Here's our education correspondent Hazel Shearing.
The NASUWT said a survey of more than 2,000 of its members at the end of last year suggested 70% of teachers had seriously considered leaving the profession because of the impact of their work on their children. Its General Secretary, Matt Rack, said women in their 30s in particular were leaving because of, in his words, the failure to make the job more family-friendly. He will call for national negotiations to deliver 26 weeks of fully paid maternity leave across the UK when he addresses the union's annual conference in Birmingham today. The government's recent schools white paper proposed doubling the amount of time teachers and school leaders in England receive full pay or maternity leave from 4 to 8 weeks. The Department for Education said a new programme would also support women returning after leave.
Thousands of Easter rail journeys will be disrupted by a shutdown on the West Coast Main Line that begins today. The closure is part of a £400 million upgrade, as Mark Ashdown reports.
Totalling around 1,000 miles of track, the West Coast Main Line is Europe's busiest mixed-use railway network. It carries around 40% of the UK's freight traffic and is used by millions of people a year to travel between London and cities such as Birmingham, Manchester, Glasgow and Edinburgh. But from today, there'll be no trains on a stretch of it between London Euston and Milton Keynes until next Thursday. There are also major engineering works planned around Preston and Carlisle. Passengers are advised to check for diversions and replacement buses. Network Rail said its engineers would carry out 270 projects across the UK over the weekend, but promised that the majority of the network would be open.
That was Mark Ashdown.
Thank you, Tom. It's 10 minutes past eight. Where is the line between attacking military and civilian infrastructure in the war in Iran? President Trump made a point of saying that he would spare what the Iranian people needed to survive and to rebuild their future after the war. But a new strike on Iran's largest and still unfinished bridge has killed 8 people and injured nearly 100, according to the authorities there. There have been attacks by both sides on things like oil storage and desalination plants, of benefit to the military, but also vital to the wider population. And the language that's being used is really notable too. As an example, this is what President Trump said in his address to the nation on Thursday night.
We're going to hit them extremely hard over the next 2 to 3 weeks. We're going to bring them back to the Stone Ages where they belong. In the meantime, discussions are ongoing. Regime change was not our goal. We never said regime change, but regime change has occurred because of all of their original leaders' death. They're all dead.
The Iranian response to that came from the commander of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps Aerospace Force, who said, Hollywood delusions have so poisoned your minds that with your paltry 250-year history, you threaten a civilization over 6,000 years old. What is interesting is the intent in those words. Jeremy Bowen, our international editor, joins us. Morning, Jeremy.
Morning.
People are talking now about war crimes, inevitably, because when you have attacks on, or very clear language suggesting that there will be attacks on the civilian infrastructure, that is inevitably the path that people will start to go down.
Yeah, and they'll say too that this war of choice started in highly dubious legal circumstances because there was no imminent threat to either the United States or Israel. He is absolutely overtly using the language of war crimes, bombing them back to the Stone Ages where they belonged, as he said the other night on American TV. Actions in war, to be legal, have to be, first of all, they have to protect civilians, but they also have to be proportionate to the threat faced. So, for example, if there's a bridge between you and an advancing army, yeah, well, it's okay to blow up the bridge. But just blowing up the bridge because it's a big bridge and you want to hurt the country and it affects civilians, well, that's not legal necessarily. I mean, that's, of course, one would have to look at it very, very, you know, legally to see if there was a... But those are the indications. But this feeds into a wider issue, which is the whole idea of having rules to run the international order, which was quite a tatty concept anyway, frankly, has under the leadership of President Trump in the United States become something which has been absolutely pushed to the sidelines in terms of international legality, in terms of the respecting of international laws, of conventions and so on, because he believes clearly that might is right, and if you're mighty, you can be right.
And so for someone, Jeremy, who so covets the Nobel Peace Prize, but who, as you say, is using the language very clearly of war crimes at the moment, what options does he have right now?
Well, first of all, I don't think the Nobel Peace Prize is looking like a great option at the moment. But he faces hard choices. And I think that the way that his language whipsaws around the place, and you could see it just in that, 19-minute speech the night before last, and I listened to every word, it betrays his own strategic uncertainty because he has some hard choices. I think it's clear he wants to find a way out. He's hoping for a deal. The Israeli media reports that the Americans have told Netanyahu not to kill the supreme leader, Mojtaba Hamanei, the foreign minister, or the parliamentary speaker, because they'll need someone to sign some kind of a deal. No deal is looking at all possible at the moment. Another possibility: use those ground troops that the Americans have sent over. One Marine Expeditionary Unit has arrived from Japan. Another's getting closer from California. Putting boots on the ground there changes the nature of this war and actually in some ways plays further into the hands of the Iranians, who would like to engage the Americans in a long war because they believe that they can wait. They can take a lot more pain than politically President Trump can do. And, you know, more widely, the idea of these endless wars in the Middle East, well, there's past evidence that the consequences go way beyond the region, and Iran has demonstrated in this asymmetric warfare, as it's known, the way that weak countries can fight strong countries, that the power of choke points, Strait of Hormuz, where so much world trade goes through, that is extraordinary. In a connected world economy, that's an extraordinarily potent weapon.
Jeremy Bowen, our international editor, thank you very much, as always. Well, let's speak to Tom Fletcher, the UN's humanitarian chief. Good morning.
Good morning, Anna.
You've been in Lebanon and Syria these last few days, which is important, which I want to talk about. But I just wanted to pick up on what Jeremy was saying there, particularly the language of war crimes, these attacks that we're seeing. For somebody in your position, it must be an extremely concerning moment to hear that and to see that.
Well, extremely concerning is a very diplomatic way of putting that. I mean, this is infuriating. We're dealing with the intended and the unintended consequences of this reckless conflict. And I think what everyone is observing now is that war is not a television game show. It's not, you know, peacemaking is not a real estate deal, and the world is not a casino. And these actions have real consequences. We're out there right now. I'm in Damascus, dealing with the huge unintended consequences of this conflict.
When do you think we got to a point at which civilian lives were talked about in such a throwaway way as they seem to be now?
Yeah, I preferred the episode when we were talking about peace, to be honest. This has been a gradual and then very sudden deterioration in the way that we talk about protection of civilians, the way that we talk about international humanitarian law. You know, this stuff isn't negotiable. You don't hit civilian infrastructure. That includes hospitals, you know, across Beirut and across Lebanon. I met huge numbers of medics whose ambulances are being hit at the moment. You don't hit schools. You don't hit energy sources. You don't hit bridges. Those are war crimes. That is absolutely clear in international law. But somewhere along the way, we seem to have thrown that all aside, and we've chosen impunity, indifference, game show gambling over solidarity and humanity.
Do you think it is the end of the international rules-based order? Jeremy was saying there it was looking tatty already in the way that some countries deal with it. Is it that the
there isn't a strong enough international legal system to deal with this. I just wonder how we get things back on track, or is that gone now?
It's not gone. And I don't agree that the rules are tatty. The rules are very clear and very strong. And they were
I think Jeremy was meaning more that people's response to them.
Absolutely. Don't worry, I very rarely disagree with Jeremy. these are really clear, strong rules. There's not a problem with the rules. The problem is the enforcement. And I think my hope is that the silver lining of this terrible crisis is that the world comes to its senses. It gets serious again and comes behind the international order, comes behind the international system. You know, the United Nations, we've been under sustained attack. But, you know, we were made for times like this. And if people say that we're no longer relevant, no longer useful, tell that to the people I'm with right now in Damascus and in Lebanon over the last few days, risking their lives, literally losing their lives. We lost three colleagues in the last week in southern Lebanon, three peacekeepers. You know, we're out there dealing with the consequences of this mess.
Tell me about Lebanon, because you were there, as you said, for the last couple of days. You're meeting people on the ground, but you're also having some very high-level conversations, because one of the issues here is the disarmament of Hezbollah, something which the Lebanese government is trying to do, the Lebanese armed forces are trying to do. They're not managing to do it at the moment. And what they're seeing in response is Israel occupying parts of Lebanese sovereign territory as a result. How can that situation be dealt with? What are people at the highest level saying to you? What do they need?
It's really grim right now. And, you know, I was in Lebanon for 4 years as ambassador, and you develop an antennae because you're constantly judging, you know, do we need to evacuate people? Is the situation getting worse or better? Are we a frog in boiling water? I've never known levels of tension, anxiety, despondency like I experienced the last few days. And that's from our colleagues, that's from the civilians who I was meeting, who are, you know, hundreds of thousands displaced, including from the south. One in five people right now is displaced, but also from the senior levels. And I met the president, I met the prime minister, I met the speaker of parliament. They are very worried about these huge numbers of people under coercive displacement, forced displacement from south of the Litani River into other areas. And often those areas are getting messages saying, do not take these people in. If you take in these refugees, then you too become a target for military strikes. They're also worried that as Hezbollah gets squeezed, and of course Hezbollah's rocket fire has got to stop, just as Israel's airstrikes have got to stop, but as Hezbollah get further squeezed, there is a risk that we get back to that real political tension and the political assassinations that Lebanon has known in periods like this in the past.
Are the Lebanese government getting the support that they need from the international community? Because as you rightly identify, things have been enormously difficult on all kinds of levels in Lebanon for years. And it feels like it would appear to be a moment where they need some help from outside. Are they getting that?
So in terms of the funding, we launched an appeal for $308 million a couple of weeks ago. We're about a third funded. So we're failing on that test because already the needs are far outstripping what we were looking for.
What about the political support as well?
On the political support, so you will hear everyone saying we cannot let Lebanon fail. And now is a massive test of that. You know, in recent weeks, the Lebanese leadership made this actually historic. If you've been following this for decades, as many of us have, a historic offer of dialogue with Israel to try and end this crisis, which is, as they told me at senior levels, that's implicit recognition. That is a major, major leap forward. They've also made much clearer commitments on disarmament of Hezbollah. Now, those offers haven't been responded to yet, and it's very difficult to negotiate during a conflict. But look, I pressed the Security Council a couple of days ago from Beirut. I said that given the trajectory that some Israeli ministers have described, given what we've seen in plain sight in Gaza, and now they're saying we're going to flatten Lebanon, how will the international community protect civilians? How will we prepare collectively for the risk of another occupied territory, this time in southern Lebanon once again? And how will we act to prevent this return of political assassinations and political strife across Lebanon?
Tom Fletcher, the UN's humanitarian chief, thank you for joining us.
22 minutes past eight. Let us go back to space, turn our thoughts to the heavens and find out what's going on with those four people floating around in their tin can high above it all. A few hours ago, ABC News interviewed the astronauts while they were en route to the moon in a live stream from space. Here's Canadian astronaut and Artemis crew member Jeremy Hansen, who's a first-time flyer to space.
There has been a tremendous amount of disbelief for me. It's just so extraordinary. I just kept saying to them yesterday, like, I really like it up here. I wish I could have got here sooner. It's just such a tremendous place to be. The views are extraordinary. It's really fun to be floating around, and it just makes me feel like a little kid.
There was a moment about an hour ago where Mission Control Houston reoriented our spacecraft as the sun was setting behind the Earth. And I don't know what we all expected to see in that moment, but you could see the entire globe from pole to pole. You could see Africa, Europe, and if you looked really close, you could see the northern lights. It was the most spectacular moment, and it paused all four of us in our tracks.
Having just experienced incredible views of planet Earth and seeing the entire planet out the window in one pane, knowing that we're about to have some similar views of the moon in that same way is definitely getting me more excited for it.
We have been to the moon before in 1968 through 1972. It's been a long time since we've been back. And I got to tell you, there is nothing normal about this. Sending four humans 250,000 miles away is a Herculean effort. And we are now just realizing the gravity of that.
We call amazing things that humans do moonshots for a reason, because this brought us together and showed us what we can do when we put, not just putting our differences aside, when we bring our differences together and use all the strengths to accomplish something great. And so this mission will give us one of those that we all can remember and hold on to for the rest of our days.
So that last voice there was Artemis II's pilot, Victor Glover. Before that, you heard the other astronauts, Reid Wiseman, Christina Cook and Jeremy Hansen. So what is it like up there? Well, Major Tim Peake, retired British European Space Agency astronaut, co-host of 13 Minutes Presents Artemis II, is on the line. And we heard there, Tim Peake, that it's all about the views, awe-inspiring, humbling.
Good morning, Simon. Yeah, it's so good to hear the crew in such good spirits, and they will be enjoying that fantastic view for sure. For three of those crew members, of course, they've seen that before on the International Space Station, but only from 400 kilometres away. That spacecraft's now approaching 100,000 kilometres away. So Earth is already starting to look pretty small in that window.
Yeah, that's the point, isn't it? Because a lot of people won't appreciate that. You know, if you think once you get into Earth's orbit, it's only, you know, it's a few yards to get to the moon. But this is actually quite a lot further.
It's a lot further. Yes, 400,000 kilometres is the journey to the moon they're going to take. And that needs a lot of speed. So in the early hours of this morning, 1 o'clock our time, they did this translunar injection burn. That was the final burn using the European Space Agency service module that gives them that enough energy to make this journey to the moon.
Yeah, and if I'm right, the uses then the gravity of the moon to sort of spin it back and shoot it back to Earth.
It will. It's a strange journey because that burn accelerated the spacecraft up to over 24,000 miles per hour. But already in less than a day, they've slowed down to 5,500 miles per hour. So actually, they cover a lot of distance to begin with. And now over the next 3 days, it'll be a slower journey because Earth's gravity is trying to pull them back. So they're slowing down. But it's like going over a humpback bridge. They'll get to a point where the moon's gravity will start pulling them in.
Yeah. And I suppose, can you just tell us sort of what it's like? We're talking about them having a few hours sleep. I just can't imagine sleeping in that environment.
It will be difficult, especially for Canadian Jeremy Hansen. This is his first mission to space. And normally on the first day or two, you're just, getting your space legs. You might have a little bit of a headache because of the fluid that rises up into your chest. You might feel a little bit sick. So sleep's going to be difficult, especially in a small minivan sized spacecraft where four of them are having to work.
Yeah. And I just wonder whether you start getting a bit blasé about it floating around, whatever, because I can imagine that the nerve-wracking bit is at launch, because everything's shaking around. You think, oh, blimey, which bolts are working their way loose? And once you get up there, things calm down a bit.
Yeah, launch is definitely a major part of this mission. It was fantastic to see the Space Launch System go off so flawlessly. A really great launch. And they did that first orbit, a high Earth orbit that took them out to 70,000 kilometres in order to give themselves one day in space to try the spacecraft out, test the comms, test the navigation, test the manoeuvring system, so that when they made that translunar injection burn, they knew that spacecraft was operating as well as it could be. But yeah, the view is going to be great. take for them from now on.
Now, I have to ask you this. If you look at the front pages of quite a few of the newspapers this morning, they're talking about the loo facilities on board, saying that there was a problem with the toilet and there was a blinking light alert. There's some very amusing headlines. I'm just thinking that, you know, a broken loo and zero gravity aren't happy bedfellows, I'm imagining.
No, they're definitely not, and it might sound a little bit mundane, but, you know, the loo is an important facility. On the space station, we've got the luxury of two or three, so if one breaks down, then there's redundancy. But it was up to Christina, who is a flight engineer, and she was very proud to fix that loo, so well done, Christina.
Space plumber. And just a final one, do you still wish you were out there? Do you still think about it? Do you dream about it ever?
I think every astronaut I know wants to be on that spacecraft. We can't wait to speak to this crew. They're four good friends of mine. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I do hope for another mission back to space, but we'll see if that comes off. But every astronaut wants to go again, for sure.
OK. Thanks for talking to us. Major Tim Peake there, retired British European Space Agency astronaut. I say retired, maybe not, from what he was just saying there.
Yeah. From a layman's perspective, by the way, I made a documentary a few years ago about the women of NASA, and I saw the Orion capsule, the training version of it that they have in this huge training set. They've got real life versions of the International Space Station, all sorts of things, so they can learn how to use it before they go. And one thing I would say about Orion is it's absolutely tiny. You wouldn't want to go to the moon in it yourself, let alone with three other people. So when you talk about the toilet issue, I think, you know, it sort of brings back childhood caravan holidays and that sort of thing. They've got a lot to consider when there's four people sharing a very small space. From that, on to the sport with Jonathan. Hello.
Hello there. From the moon to cloud nine. You'll understand why in a minute. I've got a question for you. What's the best preparation for an FA Cup quarterfinal, especially if you're playing the club world champions? 72 years ago, when Port Vale last reached this stage of the competition, they stayed at a top London hotel and they spent the night seeing a show in the West End. And it helped because they won the tie at Leighton Orient to reach the semi-finals for only the first time in their history, and the only time indeed. So how are modern-day Port Vale preparing to play eight times cup winners Chelsea at their Stamford Bridge Stadium tomorrow? Let's talk to club owner and chair Carol Shanahan. Good morning.
Good morning, Jonathan.
So it's a Swish Hotel and a show again, is it tonight?
It's a Swish Hotel, but it won't be a show. It'll be a quiz. We have a quiz when they go away on a Friday night. It'll be sticking to normal routine. You don't want to go out. Then you certainly don't want to be taking them to the West End to a show.
OK, then. let's see if it brings you luck. Special anniversary black and white kit, though. Tell us about that.
Yes, so this is our 150th year, so we had commemorative strips for home and away, and the one that my son Patrick designs all the kits, and he went through all the history and got the best defence year and the best attacking year that we'd ever had, and 1953 was the Iron Wall, it was called, and so this is the same kit, and we haven't had a front of shirt sponsor, so we could stay really true to the 1953-54 strip, and they'll be wearing that today. Only the socks will change because VAR didn't like our socks against Chelsea's socks, and they didn't have that problem in 1953.
That's fascinating about VAR. We're talking about the moon. It must feel like you're entering another universe because Port Vale announced losses of £6.1 million just recently. Chelsea announced a record loss of £262 million. As a successful businesswoman, how would you face up to that?
Well, as a businesswoman, you'd never go into football. Yeah. My daughter did a master's degree in business finance at London Business School, and they had this whole lecture about how businesses work. And at the end of it, the lecturer said, all of that doesn't apply to football. Football is the only industry in the world that doesn't follow these rules. And it doesn't, because it relies on the benevolence of the owner. So as a business model, it doesn't work at all, which is what we're seeing with these losses. You know, you've got the losses up there with Chelsea, and they'll kind of cope with that. But when you get into the lower leagues, these amounts mean more and more because they're focused on fewer and fewer people. So if you look at ours, it's only our family, you know, and that's the same for a lot of League One and League Two clubs. So it is a lot of losses to absorb, which is where football's got a real challenge at the moment.
So how sustainable is football at any level? Because so few clubs make a profit.
But it isn't. As its current model, it absolutely isn't sustainable, which is why when the independent football regulator was being announced, there was a great hope that what they would do was enable, well, they would go and get the Premier League to let the money flow down through the pyramid, because that's what it needs. It needs an independent voice that has clout to be able to say, we need to save this industry. And to do that, we need to make it sustainable. And to make it sustainable, we need to make sure that the money is distributed more fairly, particularly the media money. And that's what I'm really still hoping that the independent football regulator does. I was asked yesterday by the EFL to be one of a few club owners that speak to the IFR as they are setting themselves up as to what the club owners would like to see. And we're pretty clear on what we would like to see, to be honest. We would like a sustainable industry that means that we can deliver this entertainment, this sport, to all our fans.
Two final questions then. You beat Sunderland in the previous round, Premier League team. You're bottom of League One, so why not take it again and beat Chelsea, who are sixth in the Premier League?
Well, that's the whole thing with the football club. Magic happens. Let's just hope magic happens tomorrow. Tomorrow.
Cheers.
I'm getting lost with my days. Yeah, it all became real this morning, Jonathan, because the details from Chelsea arrived for the boardroom etiquette, and you know
what do you have to do.
So,
tell us.
Well, actually, it's a lot less than you do in some League One and Two clubs. You know, it's a smart, casual dress code, which I was quite surprised, because there's some clubs where if you don't wear a tie, you can't come in. Whereas they're a lot more chilled.
Okay. So, final key question. How is your new billy goat Treacle? Because you missed that tie against Bristol City because the mother cinema was expected to give birth and didn't for about a week later. So is all good at the home, at farm?
All is very good at the home. I've just had a report this morning that he's put on even more weight. So he's doing well. He is being absolutely mollycoddled. He's the only child in the farm at the moment. So we're all doting on him. And he'll be on breakfast today, tomorrow morning, on BBC One. We had a call last week from Mike, and he came along and filmed him. So he's a star.
Very good. Well, he may be the star in the morning, but you need to be the star on your team in the afternoon. Live on BBC One and Five Live, kickoff 5:15. Carol Shannon, thank you very much indeed for your time. Enjoy the day and the quiz. And just to say, finally, every ball of every county cricket championship match is live on the BBC Sport website and app, plus via BBC Sounds. It all starts today. That's why it's so cold.
Jonathan, thank you. It's Desert Island Disc at 9. Here's Lauren.
My castaway this week is the TV presenter and hairy biker, Cy King.
You know, if you're going to cook something, you cook it with your heart and you cook it with your soul, and don't cook in a bad mood.
Oh, don't cook in a bad mood.
No, because you'll taste it. Mm. You'll taste it. You'll taste that anger. And it's actually true.
I think I've made cakes like that before. Cy King is my castaway this morning at 9.
The weather today will start off dry and sunny for many of us, but will turn cloudier into tonight with rain developing. And don't forget, Storm Dave is on the way tomorrow.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Simon Jack. And Tom Sanders has a summary of the news at 25 to 9.
Executives at Marks & Spencer have urged the government to do more to tackle high street crime, saying staff face daily abuse and violence. They said a faster and more consistent police response was needed to catch repeat offenders. The Home Office said it was giving officers stronger powers. NASA's Artemis 2 mission has left Earth's orbit and is heading for the moon. The four astronauts fired their spacecraft's engine for the next stage of the journey, describing views of their home planet as spectacular. President Trump has said the US will continue to step up its attacks on Iran's infrastructure if Iranian leaders don't agree to his terms to end the war. State media say 8 people were killed when a bridge near Tehran was bombed. The UN's humanitarian chief, Tom Fletcher, told us that international law was clear that hitting energy infrastructure, schools or bridges was a war crime. A new National Democracy Protection Unit will support police forces in tackling the rising level of threats and abuse faced by MPs. A senior officer has been appointed to coordinate intelligence and help with investigations.
Thank you, Tom. 23 minutes to 9. To drill or not to drill? Does the unfolding energy crisis in the Gulf teach us that the Miliband way, a sprint for renewables to get off the fossil fuel roller coaster, is the right way? or the Kemi Badenoch way, that this is proof positive we need to extract as much oil and gas as close to home as we can. Well, I've been speaking to John Brown, Lord Brown, who worked at BP since the late 1960s, when North Sea oil was first discovered. He worked on those early fields. He went through the oil shocks of the 1970s, the tanker wars of the 1980s, and when he was chief executive, tried to rebrand BP as meaning beyond petroleum. So he has straddled both sides of this very debate. Well, I spoke to him and began by asking whether Team Kemi or Team Miliband is right with our approach to oil and gas.
Well, the answer is we need all of the above. We can't pick and choose. We need all forms of energy, and we need to make sure that we have a diversified source. We don't have enough diversification today to take care of crises in the future. The question of the North Sea, there are a couple of fields which are partly developed. They should be fully developed and go ahead. And indeed...
Just to clarify, that's Rosebank and Jackdaw, you say. Give them the green light immediately.
Absolutely. Because they're investments which have been partly made. And I think stopping investments halfway through is not a good sign for the confidence not a good sign to the market to have confidence in the investment environment in a country. But I do think that, you know, the North Sea has been a great success. I'm sure there's more to be found. I expect it's not a lot, but I think companies should be encouraged, should they wish to make the decision, and the government won't make a decision about investing, the companies will, they should be given the opportunity to invest where they can to actually produce oil and gas. But, you know, don't expect that it will be the discovery of another North Sea. It won't be, because we've done such a good job at developing the North Sea since the late 60s. So it's been a great success story. Not a huge amount is left, but enough to make a bit of difference. So I think it should be opened up.
So you would encourage new oil and gas exploration, because ultimately that's a commercial decision for companies, not governments, to decide whether it makes sense for them to have a go.
That's correct. And they have to take into account the long run pricing of oil and gas. They have to take into account their own cost of capital and the success factors. Will they actually find what they think they're going to find? And can they cover the risk? This is something that oil and gas companies are extremely familiar in doing. And they make all these decisions. The government does not make these decisions.
Well, that is a call to change current UK government policy, which at the moment says no new oil and gas exploration licences, correct?
That's correct. I think I come back to saying that in order to have a proper approach to energy right now, we need all sources available to us. And then the right mix, given the risks involved, will take place according to the people who need the products. But it's not, you know, we are insufficiently diversified as a country. We need to think now about how we can manage the risks to supply chains all over the world so that we have the right level of energy to do what we need to do to grow the economy.
So you can ride both horses, renewables and new oil and gas, at the same time. You don't have to shoot one of these horses.
Actually, that's exactly what the world is doing at the moment. It's not a new comment. It's we are actually dependent on hydrocarbons to about, 75% of the world's energy inputs. But the rest is, coming along, and it needs both the right approach to technology. It should improve every day. The right approach to cost that comes along with technology and scale, and the right innovation.
There are a few propositions which seem to me not to be able to be right at the same time. Renewables are cheap and sustainable. The UK has one of the biggest installed renewable generation, particularly in offshore wind, in the world. And three, the UK's got the most expensive energy in the developed world. How can all those things be right at the same time? And if we are in a leadership position in renewables, if we've got the most expensive energy, who wants to follow that?
So I think there are some real technical problems here. Firstly, in electric power generation, the cost of electricity is set by the most expensive input to create the electricity. And that usually is natural gas. So if you think about it, most of our electricity is priced off natural gas. Right now, that's very expensive. Natural gas selling in the UK has historically been at least, you know, at least four times more expensive than gas selling in the United States. And actually, from time to time, it's been six times more expensive. So that's one thing. The other thing is we have charged our consumers in particular the cost of investment in changing the way in which electricity is routed around the country. And strangely, we charge people for that, and we don't give them the benefit of it being used. So we charge them the investment without giving them the benefit. That seems to be something that we should think about.
In short, should we brace ourselves for higher energy prices in the future to protect ourselves, insure ourselves against what we're seeing now?
I think the whole world will have to do that. My hope is that it will be balanced. You know, we'll get some cheap sources and we'll have to pay for some sources which keep the lights on for, you know, in the case of big problems. And everybody will have to do that.
Lord Brown, John Brown, many thanks for your time. I just should say, DESNZ, the Department for Energy Security Net Zero, said our priority is to deliver a fair, orderly and prosperous transition in the North Sea in line with our climate and legal obligations, which drives our clean energy future of energy security, lower energy bills and good long-term jobs.
17 minutes to nine. The retail director of Marks & Spencer says that shoplifting, violence and attacks on staff at its stores are getting worse and wants the police and the Mayor of London, Sir Sadiq Khan, to do more about it. Phineas Keeve has written in The Telegraph today. He says, in the past week alone, we've had gangs forcing open locked cabinets and stripping shelves, two men brazenly emptying the shelves of steak and walking out, a large group of young people ransacking a store before assaulting a security guard, a colleague headbutted trying to defuse a situation, and another hospitalised after having ammonia thrown in their face. Well, we spoke earlier in the programme to M&S's External Affairs Director Adam Hawksby, who explained what they've been seeing in the stores.
The Clapham incident was one. That was a group of young people. But we also see organised crime in our stores and crime gangs. We also see individuals that are under the influence of drugs and alcohol. So I think this is really complex. It's really systemic, which is why it's important that we have retailers and police forces and politicians all working side by side on this. We've spoken out primarily because of the number of comments we've had from colleagues. Sometimes when they've seen reports in the media that, you know, retail crime numbers are going down, and they say it really doesn't feel like that to us. And for them, it means, you know, they're worried about coming into work. They might be nervous about the journey home. And that's not a position that we want our colleagues to be in.
Let's speak to Del Babu, former chief superintendent at the Metropolitan Police, member of the London Policing Board. Good morning.
Good morning, Anna.
From a policing perspective, how to deal with what was being described there?
Yeah, I mean, things are very, very different. When I joined the police, you cut your teeth on arresting shoplifters. So every probationer went along, whenever a shoplifter call came along, it was called GRC, given into custody, gave you an opportunity to make a relatively straightforward arrest, and you learnt so much about property interviewing procedures. Now, fast forward to 2014, the government then introduced new legislation, which basically says that shoplifters who stole under £200 could be dealt with by post. Now, there was a myth there that that shoplifting had been decriminalised. I mean, theft is theft, so, and whether it's under £200 or more. So that created a degree of a myth among shoplifters and indeed some people who are observing the whole situation. So I think we really need to revisit what we're doing in terms of how we deal with shoplifters. And I think from your previous interview, we heard that it's a complex situation. You've got gangs, organised crime, who are organising thefts. But you've also got antisocial behaviour, people who are drug dependent, who are going in and stealing items. So it's a complex area. And I think we really need to be supporting colleagues in the retail industry to make sure that we get back on top of this.
Yeah, as you say, there's clearly a whole range of different types of incident going on. But is there the resource in place within the police to deal with it?
Well, I think one of the things, Anna, we can't ignore is that the police have had a significant cutback. So they've lost 22,000 police officers and they lost 18,500 police staff. Now, we would all want the police to prioritise 999 calls. And I think there's some areas in neighbourhood policing that probably didn't get the attention that they needed to do. I think as the numbers go up, we will perhaps see that investment back in neighbourhood policing. But it is a complex area. And I think we need to work with the local authorities who've got enforcement officers. We need to work with the trade bodies who there's lots of really exciting work going on where town centre teams have been brought in to deal with those persistent shoplifters and also work amongst the retailers so they're able to share information about persistent offenders.
Yeah, so some of the most difficult ones presumably will be those ones we were talking about where a crowd of people turn up. That requires a really specific response.
That's right. And I think we've seen appalling behaviour by young people. There's dispersal order in place in Rochdale today because there's concerns on the internet that people are going to turn up and into the town centre. So there's something for the internet companies here who are allowing their platforms to share information and allow young people to get together and cause absolute mayhem. Now, those young people really need to understand that there are consequences. We're in the Easter holidays. If people go out and do the kind of things that we've seen in other parts of the country, then there will be consequences. You'll either be arrested there, which may be difficult, but we know that six people have been arrested, but there'll be a huge amount of footage that will be available so people can look at that footage. But I think what we've got now is internet companies that allow absolute freedom for these kind of things to be organised. And it's pretty shocking. And I do feel sorry for some of my former police colleagues who are hugely outnumbered, as we saw in Clapham.
Dal Babu, former Chief Superintendent at the Metropolitan Police, thank you.
So it's Des Island Discs off the 9 on Radio 4. On Radio 3, Dr. Sean Williams will bring you 3 hours of soothing, soaring melodies from Dvorak, Allegri and Francesco Chilea. You can find Radio 3 Unwind on your digital radio next to Radio 3 or search Unwind on BBC Sounds.
It's 12 minutes to 9. Almost 7,000 pieces of street art have been captured and saved digitally as part of a project by Art UK to try and preserve them all, well, preserve their legacy at least. And it takes in everything from older friezes to modern murals, the whole sweep. Paul Curtis is with us, Liverpool street artist, and Katie Goodwin, who's the deputy director of Art UK. Morning, both.
Morning.
Hi, how are you doing?
Katie, tell us first of all what actually meets the criteria, because as we know, street art is a very broad definition. So what have you decided to catalogue here?
Yes, you're right. It is a very broad definition. So what we've done is we've looked at lots of different artworks that are out in the street. So it's not all painted artworks. There are artworks, there are mosaics, there are concrete, tiles, ceramics, that sort of thing. But yeah, there is a grey area between what's a commissioned mural that might have been commissioned by a local authority or a business improvement district and graffiti. So we haven't really gone down the graffiti route of documenting every single tag and things across the country. This is more on artistic works that are out there in our streets. But it's a very wide definition. You've got friezes and sculptural works and wall paintings in churches. Works are quite sort of small, quite whimsical works on bollards, things on roller shutters. It encompasses lots of different things.
Yeah. Paul, what do you like about putting your art on the street instead of on a canvas or a piece of paper or whatever it may be?
Well, I guess for me, I quite like working at the large scale and I'm working out in the open. It's just something I got into by accident, really. It obviously appeals to, or it's taken in by a much larger audience. And I think that's something you also have to be aware of, that, you know, you're not painting to a niche audience, you're painting to the general public. So that's something I take into account when I do designs, yeah.
Yeah, because as you say, it's not people going to a gallery or making a journey to go and see it. It's there. And so all sorts of different people will take it in. But also, I suppose, as well, it's not guaranteed to last if you do it on the street.
No, it's not. And, you know, some are meant to be there only for 6 months for some reason, or promotion or whatever. But some might last for decades, because we can still see Victorian ghost signs. So,
yeah.
I mean, my longest one's 10 years. So I don't know. I don't know what the longevity is for the... It will be eventually, but yeah, it is a fleeting art form, yeah.
You see, to a non-artist like me, when you've put so much time and effort into it, the idea that it wouldn't last forever feels quite sad.
Yeah, I guess, but nothing lasts forever. And I used to feel the same, but then as you move on as an artist, as you develop, you're kind of more proud of your more recent pieces than your, well, it's not that you're not proud, but you know, you see you're a better artist in your more recent pieces than your early pieces.
Yeah, no, I see what you mean. That's a very philosophical way of looking at it. And Katie, I mean, the point that Paul was making about a different audience and a wider audience, it was a really good one, actually, because there are so many people who just don't go to art galleries, don't go and see things in situ in that way. And we all deserve art.
That's right. And there are thousands of artworks around us all the time on the streets, not just murals, but public sculpture as well, which we've done a big recording project as well. So you can see thousands of those on the Art UK website as well. But yeah, I think it's really important to have them out there in the public so that people can see them as they're going around, and people need to perhaps look a bit more closely at them. Perhaps they walk past them without even thinking about them quite often, but it has become very, very popular over the last few years. Especially, it's really exploded across the UK, the amount of street art that we can see, and there's lots of festivals going on around the country. So often there'll be a couple of weeks where there'll be artists out on the street painting and creating things, and they're happy to talk to members of the public, and you can actually watch things being created. So it really does bring people into the work that the artists are doing in a very, very direct way.
Yeah, it's a good point about it being fleeting as well. And in fact, it speaks to what you were saying, Paul, about how you do it differently because you know people are going to take it in a different way. What's your of all the ones you've done over the years, Paul, do you have a favourite?
This is the question I get most often, and sometimes
I
avoid it by just saying the last one. But there's a few. I mean, there's one I did of Katharina Johnson Thompson in Liverpool City Centre, which I'm proud of just because the scale of it and managing the project on my own, and what she meant to the city and the positivity of that piece. So yeah, that's a nice one that I like to refer to.
Yeah, to talk about when it's celebrating somebody and their achievements as well. Thank you both. Really good to talk to you. Paul Curtis, who's a street artist in Liverpool, and Katie Goodwin, who is the Deputy Director of Art UK.
Now, 6 minutes to nine. As we were hearing earlier in the programme from Dame Maggie Adairin, our space expert, this mission around the moon actually does have a purpose: to lay the groundwork for a permanent base there in the future, perhaps scope out how much frozen water, other minerals might be there. So what is the commercial potential of the moon, and who owns whatever is there? Well, we can speak to Professor Andrew Coates from UCL Mollard Space Science Lab, Head of Solar System Research there, and Professor Chris Newman, Professor of Space Law and Policy at Northumbria University. Welcome to you both. Professor Coates, if I can start with you, what's up there of value?
Well, as already been mentioned, there's things like water that's come from comets and is held in polar areas, and it's the type of thing which could be used for future exploration. There's also the rock elements, things like oxygen, magnesium, aluminium, and even titanium, things like that, which you could potentially use. There's also something which is very interesting about the moon. The moon is bombarded most of the time by the solar wind, which is a stream of material coming out of the sun all the time. So actually, the last person on the moon, Harrison Schmitt, is one of the person proposing that helium-3 could be used. That's something which would have gone into the lunar surface and been kept there, and is something which is rare on Earth and could eventually be used for perhaps nuclear fusion. However, there are big sort of financial challenges associated with that, but the Artemis mission, which actually includes a European Space Agency module, which is the thing which actually fired it out of Earth orbit earlier this morning, so it's an international endeavour as well as NASA. This is going to be looking at this type of thing to see whether there are the materials, especially the water in the shaded craters towards the poles of the moon, which could be used for future exploration. So that's the type of thing.
And that would be the water to sustain a sort of permanent base there. You would need water there because you wouldn't have to take it out there all the time. Okay, I've got it. I've got you.
Exactly, yeah. Okay. So it saves you mass for actually launching things from Earth, that you're able to do this and use the resources. I mean, there are some difficulties in doing that, especially if we're going to Mars, but that's another thing. But have another mission.
Let's deal with the moon before we do Mars. Professor Chris Newman, who owns the moon?
Well, good morning. The Outer Space Treaty of 1967 is the first starting point when we're thinking about any legal question regarding outer space. It's a treaty of the United Nations, and you look at the year it was signed, 1967, right in the white heat of the Apollo missions. And the international community had got together at that time under the auspices of the United Nations in the format of and the forum of the Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space. And since that, it's been signed and ratified by virtually every space-active nation, and it's at the heart of space law. And we've got an article that's directly relevant to this. Article 2 clearly prohibits any nation claiming ownership of the moon or claiming it as its territory by claim of sovereignty, by mean of use or by occupation or by any other means.
OK, so nobody owns it. Hang on, I'm going to match you with another law. What about the 2015 US Space Act, which says that it will allow citizens to extract and utilise resources from the moon? Does that not trump the 1967 Act?
So what we've got here are two conflicting bodies of law, if you like. We've got the international treaty law and we've got domestic law. Now, there's a handful of nations that have passed their own domestic law as well. So the USA aren't the only one. We've got Luxembourg, we've got Japan, we've got Italy. And they're trying to claim that actually what they're doing is not appropriation, but actually what they're doing is using outer space. Now, if we go back to Article 1 of the treaty, Article 1 establishes that the exploration and use of outer space is the province of all humankind. So that means nations can either do this themselves through programs like Artemis, or they can authorize their private companies to explore and use them. And so you've actually hit upon a kind of key legal question here, is whether mining and using these resources is usage under Article 1, or whether using parts of the moon this way amounts to appropriation under Article 2.
Fascinating legal clash there. And also, I just wonder whether, with the international rules-based order where it is at the moment, how many people will be observing some of those rules. But can I go back to Professor Coates? Can you see scientifically a use case for some of the minerals that might be rare on Earth? You know, would the sums ever add up to start extracting stuff from the moon?
I think for bringing it back to Earth, it doesn't make financial sense. Even the helium-3 thing, which we mentioned before, it's extremely costly to do that. There are rare earths, but again, the cost involved in doing this is huge. I think the use would be for if we are going to establish a lunar base and potentially go onwards to other bodies. That's the type of thing which this would be used for. So use on the moon for, you know, maybe building new things and helping to build new things which would be going off to other planets, because sending people is extremely heavy, and you need to take a lot of mass to be able to do that. And actually, a lot of our exploration is better robotically. So missions like our Rosalind Franklin rover going to Mars in 2028 is going to be looking for signs of life there. And actually, the last thing personally I would like to do at the moment is send people to Mars yet.